And coming up later this morning on KBOO at 7:30, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. Alexa Wiley Pengali of Gangling Virtuoso, she'll talk about the Salmon Nation Artist Project.
At 9 o'clock, Veteran Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace.
And at 10, hear an interview with Omoleye Sowore, one of Nigeria's most prominent activists. He has been imprisoned 8 times and tortured for promoting democracy. He'll speak about the human impact of corporate oil interests in Nigeria.
At 10:30, Martha Odom interviews local activists from Lewis and Clark College who recently formed a chapter of Students for a Democratic Society.
And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And at noon on Alternative Radio, the speaker is activist and author Antonio Juarez, speaking on oligarchy. Thanks for joining us.
This is the community calendar for Wednesday, November 15th. Abusive off-road vehicle use is a growing problem in Oregon's forests and is threatening our public lands. Please join the Oregon Sierra Club for a meeting to discuss the problem and envision ways in which Sierra Club can use grassroots power to fight this abuse. This meeting will be held at the Portland office Thursday, November 16th from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. The address is 2950 Southeast Stark Street on the corner of Southeast Stark and 30th in Portland. Carl Forsgaard will give a presentation on successful work in Washington State to control abusive off-road vehicle use through travel management planning. Those gathered at this meeting will discuss similar possibilities in Oregon. For more information about this meeting, please call 503-238-0442, extension 300, 503-238-0442, extension 300. Register now for the Beyond Oil Conference happening Saturday, November 18th. The Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility is hosting an all-day conference that runs from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. and focuses on energy policies, oil depletion, U.S. foreign and military policy, global pollution, and climate change. The Beyond Oil Conference will be held at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228, at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Workshops include Using the Oil and War Connection to Promote Peace, Peak Oil, Renewable Energy and Efficiency, Economic Opportunities, Creating a Movement Education and Advocacy, and Global Warming in Oregon. You'll also have a chance to speak to Oregon policymakers. For more information on the workshops, visit the web at OregonPSR.org. Yearly, the Clackamas Women's Services provides shelter and safety to 350 women and children survivors of domestic and sexual violence. In Oregon, 1 in 8 women are victims of domestic or sexual violence, and a likely 20,000 of those women and their children live in Clackamas County. During the holidays, you can help provide the Clackamas Women's Services with items such as women's clothing, children's items, kitchen supplies, household and hygiene items. Now through December 20th, the Michael Minyard Agency with American Family Insurance is proud to accept these donations for the Clackamas Women's Services. You may drop off these items at 4216 Southeast King Road, Monday through Friday, between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 6 o'clock p.m. For more information, visit clackamaswomensservice.org or call 503-659-2309, 503-659-2309. This has been the Community Calendar for Wednesday, November 15th. I'm Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.
glass that holds the card and ring. Spinning loose, but wearing thin, but wearing thin, but biting through the shifting power leans to you. And the card is on a wheel.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on Kivu Community Radio, where the time is 25 minutes before 8 o'clock. And the number to join the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, this morning we're going to talk about something that is very close to my heart, which is salmon. And the salmon have been running, the fall Chinook salmon and coho have been running since September. And I have yet to get down and watch them run in Eagle Creek, which is a yearly ritual that I have. I'm hoping to get down there this Friday. The weather's been kind of not really cooperating with really enjoying the salmon runs this year. But I think it's been very good for the salmon runs coming 3 to 5 years from now. So every time it floods, I get excited because I remember how good the salmon runs were in like 1999 to 2001, which was 3 to 5 years after the big flood in 96. So every year, though, I usually go down to Eagle Creek, and right before the trailhead there in the gorge are amazing views of salmon spawning, and I'm going to see this week if they're still doing it. And I recommend that is if you want to get really connected to the principal architect of the Northwest landscape. It's a really wonderful thing to watch salmon running in the fall and in the spring. Well, this morning my guest is Alexa Wiley Pengelly.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm still waking up here, Alexa.
Me too.
She is with the Salmon Nation Artist Project, and they have a new plan to bring together artists across the region to become more active members of Salmon Nation. And this is a project that's sponsored by Ego Trust, which has brought you the trademark Salmon Nation in the form of a very wonderful book that came out about 9 years ago, as well as an annual event that they have, the Salmon Nation Block Party. And Alexa will be telling us about her art project, and well, it's more than an art project, but what she plans to do to help become, for herself and for other artists, to become more active denizens of the Salmon Nation. So good morning, Alexa.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start by talking about what your project is about and what inspired you to become more active citizen of Salmon Nation.
Initially, I had a long time interest in bioregionalism itself, just the idea of the boundary of geography versus, or not necessarily the boundary, but the landscape defining how we relate and how we achieve our economies in this type of philosophy, bioregionalism. So it led me to the Salmon Nation, which is on the Eco Trust, like you said, on their website, and kind of incorporates all these ideas and has this idea of how to build that awareness in a philosophy. It's very nebulous. People a lot of times are like, what are you talking about? I don't get that Salmon Nation thing. It's too philosophic for some people. But I mean, in general, bioregionalism led me to the Salmon Nation, and then being an artist and being an artistic thinker, and also being in a public administration degree, I'm thinking, well, there's all this regional dialogue about energy. There's a lot of regional dialogue about salmon. We're starting to think more regionally about things. What are the artists thinking in the region, and how can the artists network in a way that's meaningful and contributes to the conversation about salmon and ecology and economy and these things?
Well, let's step back to the first word that you used in this description, which is bioregionalism. Let's talk a little bit more about what is bio, what does it mean? What is a bioregion, and what is our bioregion here in the Northwest?
A bioregion, it's defined a lot of times by watersheds. The bioregion that we're talking about, Salmon Nation, is defined by, quote, anywhere a salmon can get to. So that's the area defined kind of the stomping grounds of the salmon.
So actually, I think we're talking about where they could get to historically, right?
Where they could get to historically, right.
Because there's a large part of Salmon Nation that's been cut off from salmon.
Right.
We could talk a little bit about that. But my understanding is Salmon Nation actually historically went all the way down to, San Luis, well, Monterey Bay. I guess, mm-hmm. and maybe even right. San Luis Obispo, which actually still has steelhead running in San Luis Obispo Creek, right through the center of San Luis Obispo.
Oh, wow.
But they restored a section of the creek in downtown San Luis Obispo a number of years ago, and I have seen steelhead swimming in the middle of San Luis Obispo. It's quite a scene. Of course, we have steelhead and salmon swimming right through the middle of downtown Portland, too, though our river is a little bigger than San Luis Creek, so it's you have to, like, actually be fishing sometimes to be seeing them in downtown Portland.
Yeah, it's like not a very clear river to
right.
see them in, but still nice that they're there.
So let's talk a little bit about how does it connect us, or what is there to be connected to when we think about where the salmon run, basically, where they live. How does that impact us as, or how does that make us members of Salmon Nation?
Well, you talked a lot about this in your Salmon Lands documentary, and I think one of the things you mentioned in there and that always comes back and that we talked about earlier is that salmon, they're a keystone species for the region. So they're really a measure of how the forests are doing, what's the water quality, and they're affected by the dams and the temperature of the water with global warming, the amount of water runoff, that type of thing. So they really kind of give us a little, like a measure for how the rest of the ecosystem is doing. Just like the spotted owl, they're kind of teaching us how things are interconnected. And I think one of the things you said is that when the salmon come up from the ocean, they come all the way up into Idaho. I mean, they come really far in. And historically, a lot of them would come in and they would all die and when they're after they're done spawning. Usually some populations didn't, but then their carcasses would then feed, you know, the bear and the eagle and the those animals would take it into the woods or the forest or onto the land, and then you know, the excrement, it would come out and all these nutrients from the ocean would come back onto the land and build up these really rich nutrient soils. So the salmon really has built these soils and been a huge reason we have such rich diversity in the forests. And it's just been for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
So I think perhaps the difference between the spotted owl and the salmon, which are the two iconic endangered species of the Northwest, I mean, the spotted owl are an indication of the health of a forest, and they require healthy forests in order for them to survive. But I wouldn't say that our region is dependent upon the spotted owl. It's very important that we have the spotted owl, but without the spotted owl, or the spotted owl actually is another beneficiary of the salmon. But mm-hmm. I think, and it's, there was a story that actually Walt Curtis, who's a longtime programmer on KBOO and a local poet, and he turned me on to this writer when I was working on Salmon Lands called Tom Jay, who has done extensive writing about salmon and wrote an essay called Salmon of the Heart. And it's actually online. And this is something for Alexa. We were talking yesterday.
Great.
And
where is it online? Let us know.
Yeah. And I actually don't have a website.
Okay.
But if you actually just did a web search for Tom Jay and Salmon of the Heart, you'll come upon this incredible essay that he's posted online. I found the book that it was published in originally, like, at Powell's, you know, back in some dustbin a couple years ago, and was amazed to find it there. But it's actually, you can find it for free online. And it's an amazing essay that talks about basically how the salmon have created the Northwest. And he talks about our heart connection to the salmon. But when I was reading that essay, it was the first time that I started to understand. I knew about the bear and the eagle spreading the salmon carcasses around. But it hadn't occurred to me that this went back historically, and that when this process was actually starting, and it was probably more than the bear and the eagle, it was those really large megafauna that used to roam the Northwest back before 10,000 years ago. And it was a lot of big animals that were also responsible for spreading those carcasses around. But Tom Jay, in this very poetic way, describes the way that the salmon carcasses were what created the original nutrients that we had then built up in a very, very rich soil, and that the soil in the Northwest has this amazing quality. Now, another part of, I mean, this has nothing to do with the salmon. Another reason why the soil, at least in the valleys, is so fertile has to do with the fact that most of the topsoil from Montana and eastern Washington wound up in the Willamette Valley as a result of all these floods that were happening on the Columbia River between 10 and 14,000 years ago, sometimes called the Missoula, the Brett's Floods. And these are major floods that also, the salmon had been locked up actually inland when there was this big ice dam up around where Missoula, Montana is now. And, this was during the end of the ice age. And if they were repeatedly over a period of 4,000 years, the ice dam would break or the waters would overtop it. And then this massive floods came down and scoured the landscape, created the gorge and deposited amazing topsoil throughout the Willamette Valley. And also, help the salmon to, you know, let the salmon come back down, or it gave them again passage back up to the upper reaches of their habitat. So these are kinds of these amazing images that you have of what created our landscape. And this kind of gets me to your project, because right. I think that there's a number of us who, with the help of people like Tom Jay and writers like Elizabeth Woody and visual artists like Lillian Pitt, and if those of us who have the fortune to get to know Native people who can tell us stories about Celilo and tell us the longer 10,000-plus-year history of their people, we start to get an image of what this place was like. And it sounds to me that this project you're working on is helping to spread that sense of what our landscape was like before Europeans came and transformed it so much, and how when we get back in touch with this earlier landscape, how it helps us to maybe start to rebuild a landscape that's structured more on health and less on industry.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I was thinking about after meeting with you yesterday is that my initial interest in bioregionalism and then looking at the Salmon Nation, and as I start looking at that, what I start looking at is and finding are these rich people that are engaged in this and know so much more than I do, or have grown up in this, or have a native stake, or stories and art that are ancient. And so it's really interesting just for me that all the people that I've come across or met, or that I've still just scratched the surface of this. And it's so intriguing. It's something you could spend your whole life just unfolding and uncovering, and then it leads me to say, you know, to you, and then I get to go on Media Project and listen to your Salmon Lands, and now, you know, hear about Tom Jay, and it's almost like a journey towards my own heart, but it's really connected to the salmon, and it's really connected to all these other people that are engaged in the landscape. So it's a unique journey for each person, but I find a web is there.
Actually, I guess a caller called with Tom Jay's website. So this I'm going to thank Aaron, our engineer extraordinaire, who looked it up. It's really nice having a computer in the air booth now. So Aaron was busy Googling while we were talking. And it's thelateralline.com. The lateral line, lateral, it's actually thelateralline. So, and that's oneword.com. The essay is called Salmon of the Heart, and it's right there on the website, and as well as photographs of Tom and his partner, Sarah Mall, Joe Hanney, I think is her last name, their artwork. They do a lot of artwork related to salmon, as well as a lot of salmon restoration. So it's an amazing resource. Again, this is www.thelateralline.com, and on that website you can find Tom Jay's essay, The Salmon of the Heart. And it sounds to me, Alexa, who, by the way, I am talking this morning with Alexa Wadley Pengelly, who is one of the leaders in a project called Salmon Nation Artist Project, and we'll be talking more specifically about how you can get involved with this project if you are, I guess, a visual artist, audio artist, or anything in between. But we're talking this morning about the whole concept of Salmon Nation and having, bringing artists in the region, kind of creating a bioregion of artists, I guess, or figuring out what the artistic bioregion is. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. And it's about 11 minutes before 8 o'clock here on Kibu Community Radio. And we do have a caller already. So good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
We're fine.
Very well. Now, I heard you say that the Earth has been in existence how long?
Okay, I'm not going to get into an argument about creation, if you want to call it creation science or creationism. So if that's what you're calling to talk about, then we can have a conversation about that some other time if we just said.
Actually, I'd like to talk about the salmon.
Okay, well, that's a good idea.
And the salmon's relationship to the bears.
Okay.
Do you think that the salmon evolved from the bear or the bear from the salmon?
Actually, we will not have this conversation because the bear and the salmon did not evolve from each other. Their common link in evolution was way, way beyond that. And this is a conversation that's completely off the subject. So thanks for calling. I also want to say that I would really welcome callers who are new callers today. And we would like those of you who call every single day to sit back and listen to the voices of other people today. And we also are talking this morning about salmon, specifically about salmon, and even more specifically about the whole concept of salmon nation. So other topics are not going to be relevant today, and we won't be following up on those questions if you call up with things that are completely contradictory to what we're talking about today. But we do have another caller. Let's see if this caller is a little more relevant than the last one. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
This is, I think, relevant. I come from Santa Maria, California, which is near San Luis Obispo, and the Salmon Run definitely goes further south than that, in lots of rivers like the Sespe, and I just wanted to volunteer that there's some people who even think they went all the way down to Baja, but that's not, proven. But
yeah, actually, the maps in the Salmon Nation book, I think, show runs all the way down to Baja historically.
Do they?
I think so. Okay. I mean, I might be wrong. So somebody who actually is more involved, somebody who has a copy of Salmon Nation.
I should have brought it.
I have it too. It's my bedside table. But if anybody has a map from Salmon Nation, they can call up and tell us exactly. But my memory was that I know that they ran much further south than San Luis Obispo. I think though that what I'm thinking is that San Luis Obispo is as far south that I know of where salmonoids are still running.
And you. Sometimes they're still seen in the Sespe near Oxnard, but that's as far south as I know that they still run.
So salmonation
is concrete.
Right. Salmonation one time was the entire west coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I also wonder, since salmon require cold water, I don't know if they would have been running all the way down to Baja after the end of the Ice Age.
That's what I wonder too, but that's what I've read sometimes. And I have to go to work, but I was wondering if I did have a question that I won't be able to take on the phone, but I was wondering if any of the art involves science, like art around the lateral line or any of that kind of stuff, drawing art and the science of the salmon together. And I have to go.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for calling. I'm going to let Alexa respond to that, but I want to say, getting back to Tom Jay, I mean, his website, The Lateral Line, maybe somebody can explain this better than me, but it has to do with kind of the ways that salmon navigate. And I'm not sure if the lateral line is a physical part of the salmon's body or it's more like a metaphysical extension of their body. But, and it's kind of, I don't even know how totally scientifically proven the whole concept is, but this is the way that the theory that the salmon navigate and the way they're able to find their way back home, to their spawning grounds is via the lateral line. However, the native people, there's a very interesting story that I was recorded for Salmon Lands, where Bruce Miller, who was a Squamish Indian up on the Olympic Peninsula, and he described how the salmon actually they were taught to taste their way all the way to the ocean, and then they taste their way back. And that's kind of an interesting way, which may just be another way of describing the lateral line. But Tom Jay and Sarah Maul's work actually does kind of incorporate science and art and literature and activism and restoration. And it's a really interesting intersection. So I will offer this to you now, Alexa. So how much science are you encouraging in your project?
I think it's completely relevant. And there's a lot of, you know, Da Vinci is an artist who's, you know, a scientist as well. And actually that's a really, really good combination that I would encourage in this project. What's his name? Thomas Lewis says we need a new and better science, but for now we're dependent on the poets. There's sort of a art brings to science and science brings to art. There's a partnership there. Max Wyman from Vancouver, BC, I just saw at a conference. He's the mayor up there, and he did a long talk on we need a whole new mind, and he's calling for more art and more culture in our science and the actual conference was an art and science and culture conference, so it was exploring that connection. So it's very close to my heart, the science and the art combined. So if somebody had something that was maybe more scientific, I mean, I was even talking to someone about GIS maps or something. It's all, in a way, interpretation, what we you know, think is science and what we think is art, sometimes I think can overlap.
So actually, let's talk a bit about what is this project going to consist of?
This project is actually going to be a CD project, which is going to have a booklet that does show some stories and some visual artwork, and it's going to be mainly a music CD. So we're looking mainly for audio stories, but we encourage any kind of artist that wants to get involved to get involved, because we're looking to start a regional dialogue around the art. And this CD is the first kind of project, and because of our, you know, small budget, and we hope to that, you know, eventually it can be more of an interactive thing where there's maybe forums, we get together and we talk, or different conferences, interactive website where, you know, there's a song put up every week, and it doesn't have to be this submission process. But for now, the project is a CD project, and there is a call to art on our website, which is www.ganglingvirtuoso.org. And gangling virtuoso is kind of another way of saying wandering artist, stumbling refinement, you know. Gangling virtuoso, just like it sounds. And then if you scroll to the bottom there, it's SNAP, Salmon Nation Artist Project. And that will give you the submission information right there. And then my website, alexawiley.com, you can get my email off there. And if you want to ask me any questions, feel free that way, because I don't think there's a way really to contact us except through the P.O. box on the call.
Yeah, but I did track you down on the website. It's,
okay.
The links are pretty good.
Okay.
So you're looking primarily at this is a call for music, pretty much. Is there any spoken word that you're also interested in, or is it mostly at this stage of the project, you're looking for music pieces?
We're looking for music pieces, and what we're going to do is set the music pieces in a bed of story. We have some interviews from some Salilo elders that we're hoping to use pieces of, and this is before the Dalles Dam was built, or they had fished at Salilo before the Dalles Dam. And, you know, we're going to go down and listen to the Fisher Poets on the coast in February. And they have, you know, they have a whole community there of artists that are fishermen as well, or fisherwomen. And this project is a process. You know, I kind of stumble into people here, you know, I just found out you're a musician. I get to go listen to some of your awesome music. And, but mainly, you know, yeah, we're looking for stories. We're looking for sounds, and songs to put in there, and then also the visual art to go with it, and then, you know, poetry, we can put some words, and we can also reference those websites and those artists as well.
So besides the CD project, there's going to be this website, which is interactive and will kind of augment and have more, I'm assuming, visual images and spoken written word.
Yeah.
And then audio as well on the website.
Yeah, with a kind of an underlying concept of sustainability, which is the regional artist dialogue about sustainability, which will involve science, which will involve these things. But how do we approach it, you know, how do artists approach these issues, you know, differently than maybe an economist or a politician or something? So these artists can sort of come together, and we can debate about sustainability. And sustainability, you know, in the sense that cultural diversity is as important as biological diversity, that we need to have these different voices and these different cultures, and we need to also nurture and sustain that and give voice to.
Well, I was thinking in that connection between science and art. I was going through these cards at New Renaissance Bookstore a couple of weeks ago, and they were mainly pictures of different swamis and other Eastern mystics with little quotes. And then there was Albert Einstein, my favorite Eastern mystic, who, you know, every time I come up with I see a new Albert Einstein quote, you really get it, you know, this guy was amazing. So this quote was, science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. But I thought the same thing could be said about the connection between science and art. That that science is, we need to be scientific, but when science is just out there by itself, the bare bones of science, without any infusion of spirituality or culture or art, I guess I would say, yes, it's lame. And I think that Albert Einstein didn't mean lame like thumb or duh. I mean, I think he meant it couldn't. It
was handicapped.
Handicapped.
Can't
it couldn't. It was not. Was not very mobile. Anyway, you are listening to KBOL Portland listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's about 30 seconds before 8 o'clock here on KBOO. My guest this morning is Alexa Wiley-Pengelly, and she is with the Gangling Virtuoso, an interesting name. And she is one of the two. Well, we should actually talk a bit about your partner, who's because she's not the sole member of either the Gangling Virtuoso or the Salmon Nation right. Artist Project, which we were talking about this morning. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. And we do have another caller, so good morning. You're on the air. Let's see if we can find our caller. Hello, you're on the air. Well, they were there. I guess they're gone. But anyway, if you wanted to give join the conversation, do give a call at 503-231-8187. So let's talk a little bit, Alexa, about kind of the bioregion of artists. Like, how do artists become as much a part of a bioregion as the salmon, let's say? What's the connection between where the salmon flow and where the artists create?
That's the question, and that's a question I'm going to keep asking. Because it does feel very philosophical, but then when I look into it, it feels very real because, you know, meeting someone like you or, you know, experiencing some of Elizabeth Woody's poetry, these kind of artists that are definitely from place, like, even Jules Graves up in Washington, when you hear certain artists, they're influenced by the place that they live, the issues surrounding the places that they live and where they're committed to and the land that they're, and so we're not really looking for, you know, people that are just, you know, we're not going to go get a song from somebody in New York. We're not going to go to Brazil and find the greatest song. We're really looking for, you know, who are the voices and who are the, what's the culture? What is the tapestry? What is, so it's a question. It's, and I'm stumbling across them as we go.
Well, Erin Sexton Saylor, who I want to give a lot of thanks to. I don't give her enough credit on this show. Anyway, she's been the engineer for the show for quite a while now, and she does a great job. And she's really on top of it today because she's been Googling like crazy. So she's come up with the Salmon Nation website. And this is Echo Trust. If you go to echotrust.org, we'll get you linked to a whole lot of websites. But I was actually talking with one of the Echo Trust people a couple months ago, and I made some comment about your website. He corrected me, websites. I think that they've, I don't know how many they have. So one of them is www.salmonnation.com, and it's got a map of the land and waters of Salmon Nation. And according to their map, it originally went all the way down to Baja, into Baja. And this doesn't, Erin didn't tell me whether it's Baja, Nord or Baja Sur. But I do believe it's probably, all we know is somewhere down into Baja, California.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that was the historic range, Baja Nord. And so it was the original range of the salmon. And it gives you a pause to think, I think, about, you know, just how much we've shortened. And I don't know how much of the shortening of the salmon range has to do with climate change, some of it which was natural. I think the human-made climate change is something we probably would only say has we've been experiencing for a century. I'm not sure how much of it had to do with industrialization, how much it had to do with overfishing, and I don't know who has the answers to that.
Well, there's a lot of really good books, there's different ways to look at it. There's ways to look, well, it's just the population. When the population's bigger, you know, the salmon are going to disappear, or you know, well, it's really all these dams we've put in, or there's a lot of different theories. Likatowicz, I think Jim
Likatowicz, yeah.
Jim Likatowicz wrote a really good book. And one really interesting thing that he points out is it's almost like our, and what I kind of connect with is it's kind of our economic model. Like when we came, or we ancestors, white people, Manifest Destiny, came across the United States, we had a very different way of looking at the landscape and relating to the landscape than the native population that was already here and subsisting off the salmon for thousands of years in a sustainable manner, in a way that allowed the salmon to exist, coexist. And when we came, we were pretty much, it was a gold rush. If it wasn't gold, then it was salmon. If it wasn't salmon, it was trees. If it wasn't trees, it was the beaver. And we almost wiped out the beaver. You know, we've deforested so much. And as we know, everything's interrelated. So the beaver actually helped the salmon. They had kind of a little relationship.
Actually, the beaver built dams that, the beaver built dams that enhance salmon habitat, as opposed to the Army Corps of Engineer who builds dams that destroy salmon habitat.
Right. And funded through, economic, FDR's New Deal, and it's going to create all these jobs. And, so we have our organizations that do things for us, build and develop. So it gets very complicated if you look at it. But simplistically looking at, if we shift our economic values, if we shift our relationship to the land, will that also shift our, the actual structures that we build and how we associate value to things?
Yeah, well, actually thinking about the relationship between the beaver and the salmon, there's a man who's a fish biologist for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and he had this vision of another way of getting electricity off of the Columbia River rather than the mega dams that we have on the big dams that we have on the river that block salmon passage, that instead of having however many big dams are on the river, we would have hundreds of little dams that were kind of like beaver dams that would not interfere with fish passage but could generate at least as much, if not more, electricity than the big dams that we have. The thing that they wouldn't be able to do would be able to provide ship passage, so they wouldn't, barges couldn't go up and down the river. But ever since I heard his vision of these hundreds of little dams, and if you actually go out to Brighton Bush, Hot Springs, mm-hmm. and on the Brighton Bush River, they have one of those little dams that could almost be a beaver dam, and they generate all the electricity, that they use at Brighton Bush from that little dam. And, ironically, they were required, the last time I was at Brighton Bush, to put fish passage through, and they were concerned that they were going to mess up the habitat more by having to do this kind of fish passage project than, because the fish are already jumping over the dam. It's not very high. It's like right. 2 feet or something, 3 feet. Fish can jump. I mean, the salmon can jump 10 feet or more. The salmon jumped over Salilo Falls, which was probably, 20 feet at least or more. Mm-hmm. More, actually, really pretty high. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, salmon can leap. And the beaver taught them how to leap, according to a bumper sticker that was put out by a watershed council and around the John Day River. So I think there's a lot that we can actually learn from the beaver. And then certain people, as this fish biologist with Cryptic, is an example of someone who's like watched the beaver and gone, now that's a really good way of building dams.
Was that Bob Hynith? Or?
No, I'm trying to remember his name. He's he's in one of my pieces.
Oh, nice.
Actually, in a couple of them.
Nice.
But his name will come to me later, or somebody will actually call up with it. And I want to let you know that we are talking this morning about Salmon Nation. My guest is Alexa Wiley-Pengelly, who's a performance artist here in Portland. And I learned yesterday also a public administration student. So she's somebody who looks like she's going to combine arts administration and public policy and art and salmon knowledge all into, some flowering career.
Swim my way towards something in my heart that makes sense.
And so if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 7.5 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO. And good morning. You're on the air.
Morning. Hey, another quote by Albert Einstein, and he said, "Isn't it great that our lives are so short so that at the end they can be considered to be works of art?" I always thought that was cool. But science and art is also real close. I used to volunteer a lot at the Watershed Resource Center, and I kind of helped out with Measure 34 a lot. I've kind of been watching the bird migratory channels, because they go up, up and down the coast from like the Baja to Alaska, and they go up in these channels. And one of this is kind of a question and maybe a suggestion, but I've been looking at time-based monitoring, like Northwest Watch does it real well, where they show like how forests deplete over a 20-year period or something like that. And you could show like migratory patterns of salmon where it would be like very simple animation that would, because I used to look at all these GIS maps, and you can track it, EcoTrust has all the information right now for tracking the whole West Coast of salmon and showing people how they move out into the sea, how they go through their year thing, how they go up. And you could have these little video clips that would show, like, you know, when a salmon really finds the upper reaches and it builds its little rock, you know, bed, and then it fights off all predators, you know, that come into that space, and it's kind of like its dying gasp, you know, little battle with life, you know, kind of, and it you can almost, you know, it's kind of like all your stories can interweave within this, you know, the journey of the salmon within one CD kind of deal. And I was wondering if you are connected to anybody who's doing kind of GIS modeling like that with the salmon?
I've not personally connected to anyone that's doing that type of study. Certainly there are GIS map people that I can go talk to. I know Annalisa at EcoTrust. So I'm not familiar with that. I think that they are trying to do some monitoring. I think it's been very difficult with the salmon. We've just started to understand how far they actually go and what they actually do. And I think it's been technology that they've been trying to put little chips in the salmon and follow exactly where they go. So definitely I think there's some of that out there, and that is a good suggestion to look into, because I am interested in the kind of the GIS maps and the and understanding. I mean, they go so far. They go, you know, they have a very long and far-reaching journey.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I mean. It's their journey is really, and see, and that's the connection. It's almost the Saturday cartoon version of connection to people. It's like, you know, it's like, how do you reach the majority? Because the majority is who you need to change. You know, the belief patterns of the majority are really what you're working on here. Is, and how do you present that in a real eighth grade reading level kind of fashion? And to me, that blend of science and animation or something over time. Because if 90% of Portland could get the fact that salmon go out through the sea, like all the stuff that you guys talked about today, how they go upstream and their bodies decompose and become part of the soil systems. They bring the minerals out of the ocean into the uprivers and all that kind of stuff. If ever anybody can really get that whole process, then they can't do the things that they do, you know, in our, you know, our culture that we exist in today. And so, I mean, to me, that's the goal, is to stop that process, because otherwise it'll stop us. But
definitely, and John Kitzhaber talks to that a lot too, is that we can't just do one thing to help the salmon. It's got to be like a multi effect. It has to do with the homeowners. It has to do with the people working on the river. It has to do with industry. It has to do with the dams. It's a whole lifestyle that spans the entire population. And yeah, it is very difficult to get people engaged when they're not feeling connected or understanding the connection or understanding, the salmon's plight and the salmon's journey, and then how that relates to. So I think this project, this artist project, it is a question, and I'm not sure, you know, what's the best way to get people engaged. And I think just finding out what people are saying and what people's experiences are, and what are people thinking about, and what do people know, and bringing those things together and finding ways, like you said, maybe they'll, out of that there can be some more animated sort of way of exposing that. And then there's maybe other ways that to connect to a different population.
You know, another thing that I'm thinking is just the power of actually watching the salmon in our rivers. And I've had actually very little experience seeing salmon leap rapids. And I have several friends last year who are telling me, well, they're leaping rapids over in the creek by my place, or there's this waterfall up in Washington where I was watching them leap. And I mean, I've stood at some of the rapids around Eagle Creek where there's these very huge runs that return, waiting for the salmon to leap the rapids there. And they don't ever do it when I'm watching them. But even without having seen that, there's an amazing power when you are watching the salmon spawning. And it's something I'd really like to see it become part of our curriculum and throughout the public school system in the Northwest, that every fall, classes of second graders go out to certain places where the salmon are running, and they just spend an hour or two out there, and not just watching the salmon, but there's this whole energy that shifts. Last year when I was I went out to Eagle Creek, and in other years I'd watch the salmon spawn in October, and last year I was out of the country through the whole month of October, so I didn't get out until November 10th. And I was out there with a friend, and as we were like approaching the river, approaching Eagle Creek, there was this energy that was really different. And the first thing I noticed, I was hearing seagulls, and they're making a different sound than they usually make when they're flying over the Columbia River. And I looked up, and there were a huge number of seagulls flying around the river, or flying around the creek. And then you look down, and then you start to see the salmon, and then you start to hearing the plops and all the amazing sounds that go along with spawning. And I think if you can recreate some of this through sound and image and bring people a sense of what it really feels like when, and then be able to find ways to describe the way the air smells and the way the wind feels. It's a very different feeling when you're at a river when salmon are running. It's a very special time of year.
Yeah, it's like, how do you recreate a relationship with technology? I mean, that's a handicap in a way. I mean, to be connected to our environment, how do we facilitate that? That's a really good question.
And also, I think the historical aspect also, because I interviewed this guy who was 102 years old, and he trapped a Miami Foley down in the Tillamook thing for 70 years. So he knew every animal. He knew every relationship. He knew all the trees. I just talked to him about, like, canopy layers and things like that. But he described times like in the early 1900s, you know, 1910, 1908 and stuff like that, where the whole Tillamook Bay would be covered with ducks, you know, black, you know, all these visions of these birds descending on their things. And, you know, the whole thing of the early farmers, I mean, they used to just go down when the dog salmon would be running. They would just go down with their pitchforks, with their hay wagons, and shovel these salmon, because they were so thick, with their pitchforks into their hay wagons, and take them home and use them for fertilizer for their gardens. And so all these, I mean, the rivers at that time, which were full of wooded debris and all the relationships we're looking at with wood and things like that now too, but you know, they would see these things just wall to wall with salmon. And so we're on a very tenacious place, even with the salmon. And I think people kind of have to come to grips with that, too.
It's like collective memory loss.
What do you mean by we're in a very tenacious place with it?
Well, all these systems are failing. It's like what you talk about with the relationships of one to the other, the beaver to the birds, to the salmon, to the large wooded mass that fall into the thing that build these little pockets for the salmon to build their gravel beds or, you know, whatever they do. I mean, all those things are in a relationship, and they're in a very natural nature type of relationship. Man, as a Western force, has come in and says, we can upset that relationship on a large scale. We can do major clear-cut logging. We can do, we can do lots of stuff, and so we do, and we're upsetting these balances, and so these balances are all tipping, and they're all tipping, you know, global warming itself is a tipping, you know, we've upset these balances in a certain way, and so they have a kind of a reciprocal effect to themselves, you know, they kind of tumble, and you can watch these graphs, you know, these graphs are all just showing this stuff happening. I mean, even the news on KBOO today was talking about a 38% migratory bird loss in Montana or something because of global warming, because they can't handle the temperature differences. Salmon are very, you know, connected to temperature. 1 to 2 degrees temperature differences in the running water totally changes their whole smelling, tasting, all that things you were talking about, how they taste the river as they go up. All that's affected with heat too. So that's what I mean, tenacious. You know, I think we've got a lot of things on the fire right now, and they're coming from all different directions. And nature is, like you say, is just a kind of an indicator to us that we're tipping these balances. And so that's what I believe, is that if we can ever give that relationship connection to people, then they can get, because the Christianities and all those things, they all look to a heaven after earth. I mean, it's like you say, they come in here and they say, well, all of nature is just a resource for our takings, for takings, you know, basically.
Actually, I'm going to interject, you know, there's this movement that's really growing amongst evangelicals, which is to deal with global warming and take that on as an ethical, moral issue. So I think that there is, like I've been, it's been called the greening of Christianity, but there are a lot of serious Christians who are rethinking that dominion over nature relationship and are starting to appreciate that if they're going to be true Christians, they have to really respond to the crises, the ecological crises that are facing us. So maybe
absolutely. I don't mean to typecast. I really don't. I just see a lot of religions in general looking outwardly.
Well, what you're talking about is like a worldview that we need kind of a worldview shift in terms of how we approach. Like a tower talked about when the new economy came over and we kind of subversed the economy that was here, which was more of a gift economy and looked at the relationship and to the land differently. So it definitely makes a difference, I think, in my mind, the worldview. And so with this project, I'm interested in what are the voices of the land? What are people saying? What are, and so in a sense of, you know, you asked Barbara, like, what is it, what does an artist connected to the land sound like? And it's sort of a question in terms of what is the relationship of different people who think artistically and who are poets or have stories. And they might also, you know, be a fisherman or be an accountant or be something, but they also have these stories that connect them to the land. And we can understand, like, hey, we're all coming from different places, but we all care very deeply. We need to approach this problem from a new perspective.
Well, also, what I'm hearing the caller talking about, in a way, I think, is that there are these remnant landscapes that we can go and learn from. And, I mean, that's why I go to Eagle Creek every year. When the caller is describing the woody debris and the rivers and all these things that create thriving salmon habitat, this particular spot on Eagle Creek, which is actually just as you... You come to the creek and there's the first parking lot. Then there's like another mile you can drive to get to the trailhead that goes along the creek for another 14 miles. But, there's a road that runs between the first parking lot and the second parking lot. And if you park in the first parking lot and walk up a little ways, there's a footbridge. You go over that footbridge and then you look down and there's this little backwater area, which is protected from the main part of the creek by woody debris and a gravel bed. And it is classic salmon spawning habitat. It's just beautiful habitat. And last year when I was there, I felt like the old timers the caller is talking about, that you could walk across the creek on the backs of salmon. I'd never seen so many salmon spawning as I did in that one place. And it was a great place to take children to look. In fact, a lot of kids do. I've seen a lot of families out there at Eagle Creek in the last few years appreciating that we have this incredible lesson, like living lesson every fall when the salmon return there. But it's a place to go and to be able to see what once was. And it's just a remnant of what once was. But when you see the power of that, what has been preserved at Eagle Creek, I think to me it's motivation to think, well, how do we turn the rest of the Columbia watershed into this kind of habitat? And what would it mean to the quality of our lives if we were living amongst this kind of habitat? And there's even places in Portland. There's some places in the Willamette River between Selwood and Milwaukee, which have these little backwaters and which in fact are really good spawning habitat for salmon. So I think we need to get in touch with them and really work hard to protect these and then to try to expand this view of what the river system should be. Is the caller still there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I think that's a very good summation. I mean, I think I just see it as a battle for a mindset, you know, and like you say, with the Christians, I think we'll reach that tipping point even with cultures. You know, religions and cultures will morph to meet the demand. I mean, we work in the peak oil thing, and so that's going to be another tipping point that's going to just kind of force people into certain patterns. And so eventually we'll run into the pattern that we have to preserve nature, but I hope we can do it sooner than later.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Okay, I love you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. I'm talking this morning with Alexa Wally Pengelly, who is leading a project called the Salmon Nation Artist Project. And we're talking about what it means to be citizen of Salmon Nation and how we can connect to this incredible life force that has shaped the region that we live in, and how do we become more connected to our region. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 24 minutes after 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Barbara.
Yeah, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. It's Jeff in North Portland. Art and science, what a marvelous concept. And science and architecture. What comes to mind is, for instance, Arco Santi. There's a place in Arizona where the architect structures right into the walls of the canyon in Cordis Junction, Arizona. Also Taliesin, which is what Frank Lloyd Wright tried to do down there in Arizona, Taliesin West. But what comes to mind, Barbara, is that this new greening of the evangelical movement is what I would call a stewardship awakening. This is this is what, in fact, may help lead what my brother that just called is looking for into a reality, is that we are awakening to our duty as stewards, not dominant life forces. And speaking of dominant life forces, I'm just curious from your guest, what kind of studies are being done about tidal flow electricity generation? And, in other words, removing dams for sure, but using tidal flow itself to generate electricity. Have any studies been done? Is any work being done? And what would effect would that have on Salmon Nation? Thanks so much for taking my call. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, bye, thanks, Barbara. Thanks for calling.
There are a lot of studies being done on wave technology worldwide. There's talk of putting kind of a wave electricity place where they have a lot of that stuff. And I think that's going to be somewhere on the coast of Oregon. I can't quite remember exactly where, but they're talking about getting funding for that. They're very seriously looking at that, renovating an old plant on the coast. I just can't remember what city it is. So they're definitely moving in that direction. They're looking really hard at that. And the only thing about that is we need to be really careful we don't just jump into solutions. That's my fear, because we don't really know the effects of that. You know, if all of a sudden we put all these things in the ocean, how is that going to affect the different things that are living in the tides and that type of thing? But they are looking at that, you know, in terms of like migration of, you know, salmon and different whales and different things that move out there. So there's a lot of studies being done at Oregon State University, and they're looking very carefully at that. So there's a lot of promise there.
Yeah, sure. I think that's the same concern a lot of people have about wind energy, that wind energy has some great potential, but there's a lot of thought, because it, like hydro, wind energy reminds me a lot of hydro. Yes, it's clean, it's renewable, but what does it mean when you stick these huge propellers up in the air, and there's a lot of concern about migratory birds? And I was told by a scientist who's working on wind power systems at the University of Colorado that there's no way to make them totally safe for birds. So his solution was you place them outside of flight paths. Well, there is no place that's outside of a flight path. So the best you can do is to place them outside of major flyways. And so I think that there's these trade-offs every time we're trying to create energy. I think that if we went back and we looked more at how animals function, and again, that goes back to the model of beaver dams, that animals have a way of enhancing habitat, whether it's what ants do to the soil or what prairie dogs do to the soil for that matter, or what beavers do to river habitat, or what fish do actually when they're swimming through river systems. And if we can learn more from animals, how they are part of an ecosystem, and we could become part of an ecosystem with our technology, as opposed to it being something we impose and transform ecosystems and ultimately destroy them, it would really do an awful lot towards changing the human relationship to the earth.
Yeah, which if we could fundamentally, you know, really feel a relationship more, I think the caller earlier is that we do have a lot of underlying worldview philosophies that sort of separate us from the earth. And if we can start having more of a relationship, not in an anthropomorphic sense, like, I don't know if I pronounced that right, but not in like a sense of like, oh, everyone's our best friend or anything like that, but just understanding a little bit more of the science and also accepting the mystery and not feeling like we have to completely understand, but then developing our economy out of that understanding of that relationship. And I think we do our best, but we don't address some of the bigger questions like overpopulation and consumption levels. Like, you know, we just want to maintain the status quo? And it's a very difficult question. A lot of people are working on it from a lot of different areas, so it's definitely looked at. And in the Northwest, we're actually doing a really good job.
I just saw a thing in the Oregonian this morning that while our recycling efforts in Oregon are up 9%, our garbage is up 6%, and that we produce, I forget, somewhere between 5 and 6 million cubic tons of garbage a year and only 1.2 or something million cubic tons of recycling. So this widening gap between how much garbage we're creating and how much we're recycling, even in this great epicenter of recycling consciousness. And I think Oregon does probably do more recycling than any place else in the country. I'm not sure, though, if you – though, actually – in the travels that I've done, I mean, I haven't traveled that extensively. I've yet to be in another country where recycling was on par with Oregon.
Unless it's by necessity, they have to reuse and reuse and reuse.
Right.
Because
I mean,
they don't have the option.
Right. When I was in Cambodia a few years ago, my traveling partner pointed out the recycling in Phnom Penh, though there is some recycling. We saw guys on bicycles carrying big, huge loads of flattened cardboard, and that was kind of the beginnings of recycling. Plus, the person who started recycling in Portland, Stan Kahn, is now living in Phnom Penh, and my fantasy is that 10 years from now, we'll see the recycling centers in Phnom Penh that Stan will have started. I don't know what he's actually doing there, but that was my fantasy. But the main recycling centers in Phnom Penh are the garbage dumps. And that's in the third world. There is a lot of reuse at the garbage dumps, but it's not a real organized or real healthy form of recycling. And there's a lot of other stuff that kind of gets mixed in there. But I think that the statistics in the Oregonian today are sort of a wake-up call for us to go, well, we're not doing such a great job. Even if we are doing better than most places in the world, we still have a really long ways to go. The recycling stream should be triple the garbage stream as opposed to the other way around.
And we need to still, think about not buying it in the first place. Even though you can recycle it, it still takes a lot of energy to create that. So if we can pre-cycle, which means not buy it in the first place, choose, and it's difficult. I mean, the way that our society is set up, you know, there's a road there. Everyone drives a car. There's packaging. It does take an effort. It does feel like you're swimming against the current. But I think there are ways, and there are a lot of resources out there that once you kind of look into different ways to do that and start making those choices. It's actually kind of nice to have a few less choices, you know,
and a little less stuff.
It's exactly.
Periodically I go through those purges in my house, and then you're kind of going like, what was I thinking when I got this?
But you asked earlier about another person involved in the project pretty heavily is Sarah Johnson, and this is the Salmon Nation Artist Project, which is at www.ganglingvirtuoso.org. And Sarah Johnson is a designer and a painter, and she's also a student at the Art Institute of Portland. And she's really working a lot on the marketing and a lot of the design of the project. And also other people involved and some oversight are Eco Trust, Lauren Johnson, the Vice President, Development Communications, and Daniel Etrez, the Citizenship Outreach. And then Jim Brunberg over at Mississippi Studios has offered up to do some mixing for the project. And if you haven't been there, you need to go. It's a great venue, and it's well known. So I'm sure maybe you have been there. And Norvin Johnson is an independent producer in Scappoose that's offered up. So there's a lot of people kind of involved. John Platt from the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And we had some help, especially from Cherie, who runs the Spirit of the Salmon Fund over there at the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. They helped write a letter for us. We put in a grant. We're trying to raise money. And we're going to give 10% of our proceeds of the sale of the CD to the Spirit of the Salmon Fund. And the Spirit of the Salmon Fund you can find on the CritFic website, which is Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and that's just CritFic, the letters that stand for that.
But it's actually C-R-I-T-F-C? Right.
Yeah.
CritFic. Intertribal for Fish, yes. CRITFC.org.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're having a big, probably some a lot of events around in the spring under the flooding of Celilo. It's the 50-year memorial on that. And if you want to learn more about the Spirit of the Salmon Fund, you can go on their website. And that's just another, it's a way for us to, you know, once we get this off the ground, to give back to, they have a lot of very innovative and successful salmon restoration programs that they do with the tribe's youth, and they do that through raising money through their Spirit of the Salmon Fund, which is an art auction.
Well, we've a bunch of callers who are on queue waiting to talk on the air, and if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. But just kind of in keeping with the upcoming memorial of the 50th anniversary of the flooding of Celilo, I think a really intense lesson is to get some images of what the river looked like before the dams went in. And one of the best ways to do that is to go to the Discovery Center out in the Dalles, which is connected to the Wasco County Museum. It's just on the west side of the Dalles, and you actually drive past it, and then you get off the first Dalles exit and backtrack over to the Discovery Center. There's a video that they show as you enter the Wasco County Museum of tribal fishermen standing on the platforms atop and abutting Celilo Falls shortly before the dam opened, and it was one of the last fishing seasons at Celilo, and you can hear the roar of Celilo Falls, which is an amazing sound. Cannot be replicated. It was only the sound. And people, the tribal people, talk about what the river sounded like before the dam flooded the falls. And it's a sound, as much as I heard descriptions of it, I wasn't prepared for the incredible power that you hear on this video. And, of course, this is just an old recording. So if you can imagine what it was really like in real life, it would give you a sense of just how powerful the river was. But this is, in one small way, a way of really getting a very good picture of what Celilo Falls was like. Well, we got some callers, and if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Alexa Wiley-Pengelly, who is doing a artist project connecting us all to Salmon Nation, and it's about 25 minutes before 9 o'clock on KBOO. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello. Okay, good morning. You're on the air. Let's see, we might have lost that caller, so we'll try another caller.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a couple of images for you. Can you hear me?
Yes, uh-huh. We can.
Oh, good. All right. Well, I grew up fishing along the river, or rather my parents did, and I snoozed in my little rubber suit in the rain with the water coming down, misting my face. And on good days, watched the light and shadows changed on the Washington side from my viewpoint laying on my back on the rocks just below the dam. And then got away from that over the years, and recently went back up during the salmon run with a friend. And a couple of sites, images I wanted to give you. One, I had heard, as you had, about the old days when you could walk across the river on the salmon, so to speak. And we went down to Tanner Creek, which is, if you go down to Bonneville and you go down toward the hatchery and the gift shop, and then you go straight past that and across the big bridge, there's a parking lot, and you go down these steps, and Tanner Creek empties out into the Columbia. And it's a relatively small creek at that point, shallow. And it looked like there were deeper pools and shallower pools, because of the shallower parts you could see through to the rocks, and the sun was shining through. And the thing that struck me when I went down those stairs, it looked like hundreds of black butterflies fluttering on the surface of the rippling water. And it was, of course, the back fins of the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can picture hundreds of glistening black butterflies just dancing on top of the water, and that's all you could see. But it was breathtaking because, of course, you knew the water was shallow and those were the salmon. And then, I thought there was darker shadows where the water was a little deeper until I saw those shadows shift and realized those massive areas of shadow were actually more fish under the water that I couldn't see the fins.
Yeah, if just about every creek that empties into the Columbia between Portland and, well, all the way up. But, I mean, all the close-in creeks, if you go to Multnomah Creek, which is right where Multnomah Falls is, you're going to see salmon running definitely in the fall. I mean, for some reason, I think they're more noticeable in the fall. I don't know about what happens.
The image, though,
yeah.
You're talking about an artist image,
right.
A visual artist image.
Mm-hmm.
If someone could, well, first of all, I was just killing myself because I didn't have my camera.
Mm-hmm.
But to capture that on a painting,
mm-hmm.
would be a wonderful thing. Because we have image, and of course the wonderful image of salmon leaping, we have that, mm-hmm. but I wonder how many people have seen images of these butterflies, mm-hmm. but salmon mm-hmm. fins on that top of that water. And then we went and fished up at Herman Creek, which is, you can see the fish leaping all over the place in these, you know, as you well know, in these other areas, too. I'm sure it's the same. And someone caught a fish. He had to put it back because it was, you know, it was not a keeper. It was illegal to keep it. But he had to bring it up to get the hook out. And it was jet black and gorgeous. It was, you know, toward the end of its run, but it was the most fierce thing. It was big. It must have been 35 pounds. And it was jet black with a slightly hooked nose. And I would like to send you a copy of the picture I took of that fish, because I think your visual artist or someone could use that as a stunning picture, really, of that phase of the salmon's life. And it's such a fierce-looking thing.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
So, and I don't know, I don't have a pencil handy, but I'd like
okay.
to, wait a minute, there is a pen right here.
Do you have access to the internet?
Now to find something to write on. There we are. Good for me.
Do you have access to the internet?
If you could tell me where I could email that, I will do so.
Sure. Well, I'll just give you my email.
Uh-huh.
It's hugalexa. H-U-G-A-L-E-X-A, like hug Alexa, like I need a hug, at hotmail.com. And if you could put in the subject, like salmon picture or something like that, that would
I
be
will.
Great.
I'll
that
put
would flag it.
Salmon. Fierce salmon is what I will put.
And make sure you put your full name and maybe your contact so I can get back to you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I will.
Thanks a whole lot for calling.
I think you'll like it.
I'm sure I will.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We're talking this morning about living in Salmon Nation. My guest is Alexa Wiley-Pengelly, and she is with the Salmon Nation Artist Project. You can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 19 and a half minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBOO. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the encroachment of building and development near streams, and I am concerned about nature and its condition and the health of the fish and the cleanliness of the water. And we seem to be living in an age where rapid construction and development just seems to be out of control, with not even any respect for the stability of the ground and so forth. And I was prompted to call when I heard you say, Barbara, that we need to live more like animals. And what I want to say is that actually, if you go to the old world, the homes of people are actually much more naturalistic. That is, the walls of the buildings and homes come up out of the ground, and they transfer the coolness or the warmth of the earth up depending on what season you're in. So, for example, in the middle of winter, you're going to derive some heat from the ground because the ground doesn't really cool below about 55 degrees after you dig down a few feet underground. And so since the walls of the homes are connected deep in the earth and then they carry upward, people are able to stay warm.
Okay,
in
I'm
the
actually.
I
feel like you really are off subject.
Well,
and
doesn't this have to do with power generation you were talking about?
Well, we were actually talking more about the whole concept of salmon nation. So,
to preserve salmon, we have to find a way to use less electricity, do we not?
Okay, that's
right.
True. But anyway,
right.
I'm going to let you go. Thanks for calling. Would you want to respond, Alexa, before we take the next call?
Oh, yeah. Just thank you for calling. And we do need to move more in that direction. And there are a lot of initiatives that people are taking to do that with the Cobb building and such. So that is a very good point.
But now, also as an aside, I don't think that Europe is a model for how to build, and especially the way they build right. I was looking at images of Venice yesterday, which I was waiting for Alexa to.
Right.
We were at the Costello Travel Cafe, where they have images of travel logs, basically, while you're sipping your coffee. And so I was looking at all these images of Venice and the building on the canals, and It's very lovely, but it's not ecological, and Venice is sinking pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that people who idealize, like, the way that they build in Europe, I mean, it's true that there's, I mean, in the countryside of Europe, there's some very interesting building styles, but the way that the cities are built in Europe, at least the ones that I've been to in Italy, were, I think, a model of not of how not to build.
And just, you know, if you are interested in that type of thing, go down and visit the EcoTrust building. It's a LEED certified building, and so they've done a lot of energy renovation to it.
And that's an old building that was retrofitted, actually.
Right. And So there are ways of kind of recreating what that caller was talking about in terms of utilizing the heat of the earth or the heat that we're already generating to shift and stuff. So there's a lot of that stuff going on.
Okay, and if we got a little bit more time for some more callers, you can join at 503-231-8187 and join the conversation, that is. You can also join KBOO if you want, even though we're done with our flip drive.
Yeah.
You can always join KBOO. Anyway, it's about 16 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking this morning about Salmon Nation. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I think a good image would be a fish with lesions and three eyes and then a scantily dressed feminist with birth control pills and a man with boobs with
okay,
hormones.
Okay, thank you for calling. I haven't heard you in a long time, so I guess you do qualify for, you know, one of the infrequent callers, but that's the caller we used to get all the time, every day. Been a while. But I don't know that I think that that's quite relevant either. I'm not exactly sure why we want to bring all those images together. Anyway, I think we got some more callers, so let's try another caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. That sounds like John Platt.
Oh, okay. There we go. Alexa, I'm sorry. Barbara, great show, as usual. Couple of things. One, I think your program is especially relevant now that Bonneville's carrying rates that are about 40% of the national market. They have a $3 billion reserve, and yet they're trying to cut the Fish and Wildlife program in half that's aimed towards restoring fish that were lost as a result of Salilo and a lot of other developments. Another point, I think, is that it's amazing how in the West so many sacred sites have been destroyed by hydroelectric projects, and now there's something that people can do about at least one set of them, and that's the Klamath, the dams on the Klamath that are being proposed for relicensing, and Warren Buffett and his Pacific Power have indicated that they're willing to perhaps part with them if they get properly compensated. So it's something to keep in mind and to activate about. Another point, I think, Alexa, I really appreciate what Alexa is doing with her program. Some years back, I did a program in 1980, I think, with two Warm Springs elders, Harold Culpus and Delbert Frank, who talked about their experiences at Salilo in terms of the nets that they used and how they utilized them and who was located where. And that's going to be included, I hope. And if it is, then I think it'll be quite an interesting piece for people to hear what Salilo was really, really all about. A couple of other sources for your listeners, if they're interested in going further into the subject. One is a book that came out recently by Hill, Dupree, and Rogers called Salilo, The Salilo Way, and it's spelled S-I-L-A-I-L-O, The Salilo Way. And it's about the individual Indian people who went to court to fight to keep their right to fish in the Columbia, apart from state licensing, apart from exclosures by property owners and others. They went to court and generally won their cases. They didn't win the case against Salilo inundation by the Dalles Dam, but they did. They fought valiantly and continue to fight for those rights. One other book, George Aguilar, a book called When the River Ran Wild, and it's a very profound book about the traditions and culture of Salilo, or the river people.
Yeah, I actually have an interview I did with George last year. I'm just thinking it's just been sitting on my hard drive waiting to be edited.
Good.
And that might be something for this project, too, because it was a wonderful interview.
Fascinating book.
Yeah.
It's really some stuff that you don't hear anywhere else.
It's turning into a double disc.
yeah. Sounds like it.
There'll be the spoken word part. But
great show, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
I got a question for you, John.
Yes.
I know that years ago there was talk of lowering the the backwaters of the Dalles Dam and revealing Celilo Falls. And it was kind of a little bit more than a fantasy, but the Army Corps totally stepped on it. I'm wondering, are people still talking about maybe trying to renew that idea for the 50th anniversary?
It was interesting. Washington State and the Corps of Engineers wanted to do that. And they came to our the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission and asked what the commission thought about that. And Walter Spiedis, Yakima Elder, looked at them and said, don't do it. He said, it'll just bring up too many bad memories. And imagine what it would feel like for Indian people who had been there to see the falls reveal themselves, blown up, covered with mud, and then to see the water go back up over them. I think people, the Indian people have generally said they don't want to see that happen.
Yeah, as tourists, but I've heard different people, I mean, some Indian people have said that they did want to do it. And, I think Donald Sampson said a couple of years ago that the reason why they didn't do it is that if they had done it, they would have a hard time putting the water back.
That's right.
And so once people saw the falls again, how could they live without them? I think, though, that the other part, the reality you're describing, how much mud they'd be covered with, also there's parts of the rocks that were blown away. I mean, the shards of that are now the petroglyphs that are, I think, very respectfully shown on at the park at the Columbia Hills State Park.
Right.
But that it would be just to reveal the falls for one day is not respectful. I mean, you'd have to do a lot of cleanup.
Right.
To restore them to what they were once.
Right. The only way that the falls are going to be revealed as far as the Indian people are concerned is when the dam goes out.
Which will maybe happen someday.
Someday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thanks for calling.
Sure thing. Thanks so much for your show.
Sure.
Bye.
And we've got time for a few more callers. The number to call to join the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Alexa Wiley-Pengelly, who is part of Gangling Virtuoso, performance artist and public administration student, right?
Where do those come together?
That's right. And she's working on a project called the Salmon Nation Artist Project along with Sarah Johnson. And we'll be giving you a little bit more information how you can get involved in the project in just a moment. But until then, we've got time for a few more phone callers. So hello, you're on the air. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hi, two ideas that came to mind while you're talking about this. Wondering if there's ever been an IMAX movie treating on the issue of the salmon. And another idea that might be relevant to what your guest is looking for projects, perhaps a big collaborative project on some type of quilt to explore the issue, maybe.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Include entries from all the counties that are considered part of Salmon Nation. And then two other things that I was thinking about. One was remembering and wondering if others did. When Washington State Centennial celebration in 1989 was being planned, there was one proposal to actually recreate, manipulate the dams in such a way to recreate Celilo Falls. And I was wondering if anybody ever remembered that effort. And it didn't happen for various reasons.
Well, we were just talking about that with John Platt, actually.
Okay, I heard Celilo Falls mentioned. Wasn't sure if that was the same topic.
Yeah, I think it was. It was back in the 80s when there were, I don't know which anniversary it was, but the time that I remember was, I think, in the early 80s where they were talking about revealing the dam, revealing the falls, and it was kind of a controversial plan.
Well, I remember I participated in a Washington State Centennial Games, and hearing about that proposal was fascinating to me, but it didn't make it for who knows why, but monumental amounts of money involved in engineering. The other thing I was wondering about was these recent and current proposals about killing seals and what perspectives you and your guest and others might have on that from the wildlife management side of it, and what people's fishing rights or what they think they might be in a native perspective. And I'll take that off the phone.
Okay, thanks for calling. I'm going to say one thing about killing seals. When I saw articles about how some of the tribal fishermen were in favor of killing the seals, I thought this shows how out of balance we are, that the seals and the tribes are like competing for salmon in a world that shows that there used to be enough salmon for the seals and for the tribes. The other problem being, why are the seals all the way inland to Bonneville Dam? They didn't used to go that far up in that many numbers. So obviously there's not enough food for them in the estuary, which is where they used to spend most of their time. And the other question that you have to wonder, are there too many seals? And is this a case of seal overpopulation? And I know some seals are endangered. It's kind of odd. The whole thing is odd. And it just feels like this is just another example of things really being out of balance. And rather than killing the seals, it would be nice to figure out how to start really putting things back into balance.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to. It's just a hard issue because you get down to where there's not enough resources, and then they are really scarce, and then you're competing, you know, with the other things that need the salmon as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I have these two pins that were made by this Native American artist. Two different people gave me the pins, and one is a salmon leaping, and the other one's a river otter. And for a while, I was wearing one on my fleece vest and another one on my fleece jacket, and a checker at New Season said to me one time, well, you shouldn't wear them on the same jacket because, you know, the otter eats the seal. And, I mean, there is this part, I mean, that we do share the salmon, right? The otter eats the salmon, so I'm going to say.
Right? Like,
yeah,
like,
okay, so, yeah.
Okay.
And so there's this place where we do share salmon with otters and seals and all this other wildlife. And if the world were in balance, we wouldn't be competing for them, and it would not be a big issue that the otter or the seal ate the salmon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tough issue. And I'm not involved enough with the seal issue to really speak to that. I'm not out there a biologist dealing with it, and I don't know on a whole, you know, what the Indian or the Native Indigenous population feels about that. I'm sure it's diverse as well.
Yeah. Well, we just got a couple moments left. So, Alexa, why don't you tell people how they can become involved with the Salmon Nation Artist Project?
Right now we are taking submissions of art, music, stories, and there's more information about that. And really, if you're inspired by the project, just contact us. We'd love to hear about why you're inspired, what you're thinking, what your thoughts are, all of that, because this is just an initial project to launch a bigger conversation. So we're really, it's a research question.
So how do they get a hold of you?
And we're process oriented, so I'm processing here. Okay, so it's www.ganglingvirtuoso.org, and that is the website where you can go to the bottom and find the call to art called, it's on SNAP, Salmon Nation Artist Project. So that's www.ganglingvirtuoso.org. And again, my name is Alexa Wiley, and that link is also on my website, alexawiley.com. Should be on the events page.
And so if they click on that link, then it takes them to your alexawiley.com website, and then your email is there and a phone number, I think.
Yeah, Alexa Wiley, I'm a link on the Gangling Virtuo website. Gangling Virtuoso website is a link on my Alexa Wiley website.
Okay, so you just kind of get link, and you'll get there.
Yeah,
it's
exactly. And you can find my email if you want to just email me directly. It's hugalexa@hotmail.com. Put subject Salmon Nation, and I'll make sure to get it flagged.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks
this
for
morning,
having
Alexa.
Me.
And I'm very excited by this project. As listeners know, I'm a big fan of salmon, and I could talk about it for the rest of my life. And I realized, as we're out of time here, that there's some announcements I didn't make, so I'm going to make them really quickly. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. This is actually coming up this morning on KBOO. Okay. Yeah, this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock, Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10 o'clock, hear an interview with one of Nigeria's most prominent activists. He has been imprisoned 8 times and tortured for promoting democracy. He'll speak about the human impact of corporate oil interests in Nigeria. At 10:30, the guests are local activists from Lewis and Clark College, who recently formed a chapter of, I can't believe this, Students for Democratic Society. I belonged to that when I was in college many, many years ago. Okay. At 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, a debate on the issue of out of Iraq or more troops with George McGovern, Dennis Kucinich, and the American Enterprise Institute's Joshua Morachek. And look at the new battle brewing in Congress over how the United States government monitors the money it spends on the reconstruction of Iraq. And at noon on Alternative Radio, the speaker is activist and author Antonia Usaf, speaking on oilgarchy. And also want to remind you that a wonderful video by Elizabeth Attlee has its last performance tonight at the Baghdad Theater. It's called Left to Die, the Causeway Concentration Camp, New Orleans, USA, 2005. And it will be showing at the Baghdad Theater at 37th and Hawthorne in Southeast Portland. Starts at 7:30, and this is the last screening. in this round of screenings anyway. But I haven't seen the video, but I've been hearing really good things about it. Thousands of survivors of Hurricane Katrina were promised refuge and were instead taken to a freeway intersection where they were penned in by machine gun-toting military personnel and subjected to indescribably inhuman treatment. See and hear firsthand accounts from survivors of what they refer to as the Causeway concentration camp. And this is a story that was really not told very much in Spike Lee's excellent documentary, When the Levees Broke. So this is another part of the story of New Orleans. It needs to be told. We're going to go out now with some music by Cassandra Wilson. We'll be back. Actually, I'm not going to be here next week. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll probably be talking about what's happening in the future.
It's 9:01 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up this morning on the Radio Zine, it's Veterans Voice with the Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, hear an interview with Omayele Sawari, one of Nicaragua's most prominent activists. He's been imprisoned 8 times and tortured for promoting democracy. He'll speak about the human impact of corporate oil interests in Nigeria. At 10:30, Martha Odom interviews local activists from Lewis and Clark College who recently formed a chapter of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. At 11 on Democracy Now!, a debate on the issue of out of Iraq or more troops with George McGovern, Dennis Kucinich, and the American Enterprise Institute's Joshua Marachik. And a look at the new battle brewing in Congress over how the U.S. government monitors the money it spends on the reconstruction of Iraq. And at noon on Alternative Radio, the speaker is activist and author Antonia Yuhas, speaking on oilgarchy. So coming right up here, Veterans Voice.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier.
Welcome to Veterans Voice on KBOO Portland. We thank you for joining us this morning, Northwest Veterans for Peace. Mr. Bill is with us this morning. Good morning, Mr. Bill.
Good morning, John.
And I'm John, and here with without Marvin today, so we send greetings out to you, Marvin, and your endeavors today. We miss you, and you'll be back soon, I know, next time, hopefully. And regular engineer Tammy, our best to you as always. We look forward to you being back with us soon. Our prayers are always with you. But we have Kate with us today doing our engineering. And Kate, thank you so much for doing that. We're going to probably do two halves of the show. You tuned in again to a good time and a good program, because we're going to be speaking here in just a few seconds with Gary May, that is the chairman of the Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights. He's the chairman of that. And we want to spend some time with him. And I believe he has about a half hour that he can give us. We may stretch it a little bit. And then after that, we will perhaps take some phone calls. And we have a couple other things that we want to talk about. So thank you very much for listening to Veterans Voice on KBOO Portland. And Kate, if you have Bill ready on the line, he's ready. Good morning, Bill. Or Gary.
Gary, yes. Good morning. How are you?
We're just fine. Thank you very much.
Good.
And Gary, let's just start with the fact that you're chairman of the Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights. Just tell us briefly two things, a little bit about yourself and then a little bit about the organization Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights.
First of all, about me, I am a combat-disabled Vietnam veteran, having served with the Marines in Vietnam in 1968. While there, I sustained bilateral above-the-knee amputations as a result of a landmine explosion. I'm a clinical social worker, associate professor of social work at the University of Southern Indiana in Evansville, Indiana, where I teach mostly graduate policy and entry clinical courses in our graduate social work program. Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights is an organization that, correctly, rather than it being referred to as an organization, I would say it's a loose confederation of individuals and groups who have joined together to voice their opposition to the proposal that has popped up, I think, all too frequently in Congress, both houses, to pass a constitutional amendment that would prohibit so-called physical desecration of the U.S. flag. The effort is a result of some of my earlier work on this issue, having testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee against the proposed amendment for the first time in 1999. Since then, I have been back on several occasions to testify before various Senate bodies and House committees in opposition to this amendment.
the relationship that we have with our 2,000 or more members is essentially through a web network, through our web page, veteransdefending.org, where people can sign on and let us know that they are veterans and that they are opposed to this measure. And then we represent those opinions in our testimony and work on the Hill against the proposal to amend the Constitution.
Excellent. And I'm a Vietnam vet, 6970. Bill's Korean and atomic vet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have some things in common. And right at the beginning, I want to make sure that you know that you have our thanks and our gratitude for the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you.
As a vet, we appreciate that. And Gary, if you'd like to, let's keep this just fairly loose and let you just talk about things that why this came about.
Sure.
And some of the things going on and anything that's you know, really on your heart and mind.
Okay.
We want to give you just a wide open platform here.
Okay. Well, I spent a little bit of time just now about who I am and a little bit about veterans defending the Bill of Rights, but really haven't said anything yet about the why of the veterans defending the Bill of Rights and why we think this is a worthy cause for our effort is that if the Constitution would be amended to protect, in quotes, the flag from physical desecration, it would represent the first time that freedoms guaranteed under the Bill of Rights would have been rolled back. That is, it would curtail, we believe, unfettered speech, particularly political speech, which in numerous rulings the court, including the U.S. Supreme Court, has determined should and does include speech in the form of flag desecration, burning, etc. I would hastily add that none of us in Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights advocates burning the flag or other maltreatment of the flag. The issue is not that that we promote maltreatment of the flag, but that we promote the protection and the preservation of the freedoms guaranteed under the Constitution.
What would be some kind of examples, Gary, of things that if a bill like this passed that would be restricted?
Well, the bill is quite, in some views, elegantly worded. It says that Congress shall have the authority to prevent or prohibit the physical desecration of the U.S. flag. Well, there are a bunch of very vexing issues that are buried in that simple statement. Number one, you know, what is physical desecration?
Yes.
Is it, you know, the president, President Bush, had a very famous and widely circulated picture during one of his political campaigns where he actually signed with a Sharpie a U.S. flag, an otherwise serviceable and intact U.S. flag, and he autographed it. Now, you know, the measure might raise questions about that being physical desecration, in which case the president would be subject to sanction for doing so. Wearing or having the flag or flag motif as part of clothing, the question could be whether or not that, if that clothing becomes worn or torn, if that becomes desecration. Bumper strips and flag antennas for automobiles in the form of the U.S. flag, if they become weathered and tattered, or if a bumper sticker gets damaged in an accident, could, in addition to any kind of traffic violations that might be issued, could there be a citation issued for flag desecration? And then the broader issue embedded in this definition is, what is a flag? You know, is a flag that is flown from a car antenna a flag or not a flag? Is it something else? Is a bumper sticker with a clear flag motif a flag or is it something else? And, you know, those issues could become quite difficult to get teased out. And, you know, some of the analysis done, notably by the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt, suggested that deliberative bodies courts could be tied up ad nauseum trying to arrive at definitions of these terms if the measure passed. And the way we see it at Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights is that there are a whole lot of other more pressing issues that deliberative bodies and courts ought to be considering, rather than whether or not a decal is a flag or not a flag, and whether autographing a flag is a desecration, act of desecration, or whether it isn't. So, you know, there are all kinds of complicating things that that would arise, and because of its being subject to interpretation, you know, a lot of very strong political speech that might involve the use of a flag, or even there have been history of some art displays that have used the flag that caused it to be treated in ways that some would deem to be desecration or illegal, that those things would be prohibited and thereby serve to muffle free and open expression.
Well, I certainly agree with the fact that there's certainly a lot more issues that could have some productive results rather than this. And I know, for example, if this passed, my neighbor would sure be in trouble. I got a neighbor that's got a flag he's probably had out for about 10 or 12 years, and it doesn't look very good. So I think it's been it would probably be considered desecrated. But
right. But
he likes the old rag hanging out there, and if he does, he should have the right to have the faded old thing.
I agree.
Out
and
there, it has some sentimental stuff to it, you know. So maybe the weather would desecrate it too.
Uh huh. Exactly. And then you know, the person, the owner, would be culpable for allowing the weather to desecrate. And you know, one of the other issues embedded in this is the issue of ownership. You know, I mean, you know, there's a big hot debate that has been going on and is still sort of simmering about this eminent domain decision that the court made in the, I believe it was a Connecticut case.
Right.
Where, because of some perceived public interest, people can be separated from what had thought to be, almost sacred, private property rights. The same measure could be applied to the flag. If somebody is treating the flag irresponsibly, then ostensibly the state could come in and intervene and remove that person from their ownership of that flag and take custody of it. And in addition to that, they could even impugn or impose sanctions against that person for allowing the flag to be maltreated. So, you know, there are all kinds of little gems or little bomblets that are embedded in this whole the whole notion. And again, veterans defending the Bill of Rights, rather than, you know, spending all of our time arguing the contrarian case about why this is a bad idea, although we fundamentally believe that it is, you know, we represent our position as veterans and assert that as veterans, our service in the military was in the service of the Constitution, that all of us, when we went in, took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and that the Constitution would be injured if this measure is passed, that part of what we serve to preserve is a free and thoughtful and open expression of dissenting opinions. And again, our concern is that that freedom and the sanction that that freedom enjoys would be suppressed or diminished if this measure would pass.
Boy, that's powerful, and this is a great topic. In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Veterans Voice on KBOO Portland. Bill?
Yeah, Gary, I was thinking, as I was listening to you talk, about the misuse of the flag, which is, in my opinion, constantly, you know, it's used to advertise a Veterans Day sale, or it's...
Right.
This red, white, and blue bunting you see all over the place, which, in my opinion, diminishes the significance of the flag.
Mm-hmm.
And how on earth would they ever deal with a situation like that?
That's a good question. And, you know, the principal proponents of this measure is a group of people and organizations called the Citizens Flag Alliance, which is essentially an American Legion group. And in response to direct questions such as that, their response has historically been, well, we know a flag when we see it, and we know desecration when we see it, you know, resorting
really?
To the same kind of non-defense and non-explanation and definition that gets used frequently in the area of pornography. You know, what is it? Well, I don't know, but I would know it when I see it. Well, that really isn't good enough, particularly, it seems to me, when you're considering altering the Constitution. And again, it's not an inconsequential alteration of the Constitution. It's an alteration that would roll back what seemed to have been taken as unchallengeable freedoms that are embedded in the Bill of Rights since the founding of the country.
Yeah.
So this is not small change that we're talking about, and it's not a matter of, you know, it being important simply because it's something that virtually all of us finds offensive. You know, the wisdom and the beauty in our Constitution is that even hateful or inflammatory speech, for the most part, is protected under the First Amendment freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution.
Yeah, it certainly could open the door for other things to be restricted in expression of things. What is there? And I kind of look back and I'm thinking it's worked pretty well so far.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they feel like there is something that needs to be changed? You know, what's motivating this?
Well, yeah, and that's a very interesting and useful question to consider. The last time I had a direct conversation with Mr. Patrick Brady, who's the chairman of this Citizens Flag Alliance, was last summer when I was in D.C. to be present for some of the testimony ahead of the vote on this measure in the Senate. And in a conversation with Brady, he said, it really isn't about the flag, it's about the courts. And it seems that this issue, protecting the flag, either has led or has been swept up in this broader interest that some have in curtailing and reining in, as they see it, out-of-control courts who are issuing decisions that are not to their liking. So, you know, it falls within that broad framework of activist judges and out-of-control courts that are making all these decisions, such as with gay marriage and other things that some people find objectionable. And the solution to that, theoretically at least, is to rein in the courts. And in this case, they rein them in by working around what they say is a constitutional prohibition to banning the flag, and they work around that by amending the Constitution, as if to say to courts, well, here, we've shown you now what are you going to do? Now you can't stop us from prohibiting the flag desecration. And then, you know, the broader and ill-defined notion of the culture wars that has been in play in several of our recent national elections. You know, what is it that this country stands for? And if we see marriage being under attack, then a bogeyman for that attack are same-sex marriages. So we focus all of our attention on that without much regard as to the consequences of that. So the bottom line answer, I think, is that it really isn't about the flag, or it isn't just about the flag. It's about all of these other dynamics and processes that some people have cause to find objection with about the way the machinery of our government works.
And the way that some of us live. I was thinking, Gary, what would they do? Would they form a flag police or a special unit that would go around the country arresting people for desecrating the flag?
Well, again, the issue embedded in that seemingly simple statement in the amendment proposal is enforcement. And on this topic, the Citizens Flag Alliance, again, their chairman, Patrick Brady, in a question and answer session during congressional testimony where we were both on the panel, in response, I think, to a question from Senator Feingold from Wisconsin about this, said that the punishment more than enforcement, punishment, he said, should be like a traffic citation. That is, the offender would get something like a traffic ticket and that the punishment should be for that person to attend flag school, at which point they would learn about the history, the proper treatment, and the role that the flag has played in U.S. history. And, I that's the first time I had heard that when I was sitting there at the witness table next to Mr. Brady, and I was just, my breath was taken away. I thought, here we are.
I would imagine.
Yeah, here we are considering amending the Constitution for because of this egregious offense of flag desecration, and this man is saying that the punishment for such egregious offense that requires monkeying with the Constitution is to send the person to flag school. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Could Mr. Brady give you any examples of how flag desecration has harmed us, or what brings this about? People do what people do.
Yeah, and probably I'm not the best spokesperson for the opposition's position, but from what I have heard in testimony and from what I've read from some of their documents on the web and elsewhere, part of what they see is the danger in not protecting the flag as they see it is that such lack of protection erodes the very fabric of our society, notably along the dimension of patriotism, that there is a social value served by people feeling and acting patriotic, and I certainly have no quarrel with that. The quarrel that we have at Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights and that I have personally and as an academic has to do with, number one, who defines patriotism, and number two, what sort of parameters do we want to set for the exercise of that patriotism? For example, in my personal opinion, groups like Iraqi Veterans Against the War, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and people who promote gay rights, civil unions, marriages, etc., are no less patriotic than those of us who express our patriotism in other ways, such
That's
as
right.
showing up on Veterans Day and being humbled and saluting and all of that stuff. It's really not a matter of what the outcome of that is. I think it's important to look at, what is the cause that is served by this. But the proponents of this measure say that this and allowing the maltreatment of the flag and implicitly sanctioning it, which is a misrepresentation, but they say implicitly sanctioning it by not prohibiting it erodes the fabric of our country. It makes people less patriotic, less respectful of our military and veterans and all of that sort of stuff.
Well, I would suggest
that we ought to stop it.
Yeah, I would suggest that if they want to promote patriotism, that's not the place to start. And if they're really concerned about veterans, maybe they should start with good funding of taking care of them and their families.
Hear, hear.
Also, committee could do much better by trying to restore constitutional rights to those that are in the military.
Exactly.
And those whose lives are governed by their service in the military after they get out.
Yeah.
And their inability to get redress in the court mm-hmm. system.
Yeah, in the area of these broad issues, benefits, et cetera, rights while in, et cetera, this came up, I think it was probably 2003 when I testified before the House Subcommittee on the Constitution, which is a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. And, some of us at the witness table were, making the case that this frequently is reduced to an either or, either we pass the Constitution or pass the amendment rather, to honor the service of veterans, or by not passing, we dishonor the service of veterans. And nothing gets said about benefits. And some of the members of the committee who support the measure said quickly, well, we can do both. We can pass this amendment to honor our veterans by protecting the flag and also by funding health care and other services. But interestingly, I think the next budget that the committee or the House produced for the VA was several billion dollars short. I think that one came out was the first one that came out after they made that drastic miscalculation as to the number and cost of services for returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's duplicitous. Part of the use of veterans as human shields in the service of this amendment proposal is to say that passing this honors veterans because we all fought for the flag, they say. And because we all fought and sacrificed so much for the flag, by gosh, that flag ought to be protected for everybody now that, we have a chance to do so. And again, our argument is, no, we did not fight for the flag. And to the extent that we fought motivated by the flag, it was because the flag represented the fundamental motivator for our service, and that is the Constitution and protecting the integrity of that document.
That's excellent. Thank you, Gary. I have another question, and fortunately, you are listening to Veterans Voice on KBOO Portland. And let me take this a step, because this seems to come up periodically. And if I remember right, that the last vote, didn't it fall one vote short of the two-thirds required?
Yes, that is true.
That says that in the Senate, at least, it had a lot of support. Address that issue a little bit, because that concerns me that many senators would not see the intellectual end of this.
It is surprising that it comes out that way. I've spent a lot of hours on the Hill and on the Senate side and meeting with people in offices and certainly have met with far more staffers than I have with members themselves. But I think I will say, and this is my assessment and my opinion only and not necessarily representative of my organization, but I think most people do get it. I think most people do get the intellectual argument against this measure and do foresee at least some of the adverse consequences that we think would certainly flow from this. I think the two problems. One, Citizens Flag Alliance has been quite effective and quite aggressive in engaging with candidates early in the campaign to get them to sign pledges to support this constitutional amendment even before they get elected to anything. So some people see, if they fall for that trickery, they see themselves as being on the hook, and one of the great slams against any politician is that they're a flip-flopper, and they don't want to be a flip-flopper on this. And the other, somewhat related to that observation, is that members recognize that even if they don't buy the argument that this is helpful and supports and honors veterans, they believe that their constituents believe that. And they want to vote in ways that would be pleasing to their constituents, because the prime directive for politicians is to get reelected.
Reelection, sure.
But I think the real sad part about that's kind of a utilitarian, pragmatic view on how members make decisions that has nothing to do with moral or cognitive or logical reasoning and more about political pragmatism. The danger in that, though, is that, I tell my students all the time, that policies are a way for a society to talk to itself. I mean, they say who we are and what we do. This isn't a policy, but to the extent that it's been the subject of countless hours of what I would say is wasted deliberation, and to the extent that this came within one vote of passing last summer, speaks volumes about who we are and who we see ourselves as. And I think that's quite a sad day, where issues that have a bit of nuance and complexity to them get reduced to single buzz phrases like honoring vets by protecting the flag and that sort of stuff, that it gets to the point where it comes within one vote of passing in the arguably the most important, or powerful at least, deliberative body on the planet.
Yeah, I'm of the opinion that the Capitol building is populated shelters a lot of political cowards.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue has come up so many times in my lifetime. And I wonder where they get their funding And you and I know that, that it isn't about the flag. And it seems to me that it's to place further restrictions and open up a whole new avenue for attacking those of among us that don't conform
right
to the norm, I guess.
Right. We don't fit somebody else's definition of patriotism.
Right, right.
Yeah. As far as funding, last time I was in Washington, one of the men that was with us was a former national commander of the American Legion from Wisconsin, a fellow named Keith Krull. And Krull opposes this amendment. He opposed it when he was the president, national president of the Legion. And as far as funding, he said, well, we have long known that much of the funding for this effort comes from the American Legion. But Krull was able to find out that some of the money from the Legion comes in the form of increased dues and special assessments that get levied on individual posts to support this effort. So, you know, I don't know to what extent that's true, but clearly most of us are aware of the fact that most of the funding for this effort to amend the Constitution comes from the American Legion. And part of the attraction for that for, you know, people who recognize this as one of the arrows in the quiver that can be fired in the culture war or to stem the nefarious effect of rogue activist judges, that it is that it's veterans. You know, here are these veterans in the American Legion, loyal, patriotic men and women who've served their country well, and they are saying that we must do something to protect this flag from desecration. So, you know, that you get a twofer with that. Not only do you get ostensibly millions of people who say they're behind this effort, but you get all these veterans who say they're behind it. Well, you know, our group, Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights, certainly can't compare to the size of the American Legion, but we'll stack our credentials as individual veterans up against anybody. I mean, we have highly decorated members in our ranks, in the people who support what we're doing, our former Senator Bob Kerry, former Senator John Glenn. I mean, there are smart, thoughtful, patriotic, and highly recognized military people. Colin Powell opposes this amendment. So, you know, we can provide an effective argument and provide an effective cachet, if you will, to the effect that not all veterans, and we assert that most veterans, if they stop and listen to the issues, do not support this amendment to amend the Constitution in their name. It doesn't work. I just want to add, before we run out of time, that I am a member of Veterans for Peace, and we have a chapter here in Evansville, and that in 2005, at the Veterans for Peace National Conference in Boston, the second resolution that the body passed that year was a resolution opposing amending the Constitution ostensibly to protect the flag. So my group, Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights, and my other group, Veterans for Peace, are kindred spirits in this effort. I mean, we see this issue the same way, and I'm very grateful for the support that I've gotten from VFP National in this.
Excellent. How much time do we have left with you, Gary? Are we kind of crowding
that number?
I would
say I need to wrap up probably within the next 5 minutes or so.
All right. Let me ask you just a question. I think Bill has another one too, but maybe in kind of wrapping it up a little bit, what do you see as some of the remaining challenges
concerning the amendment?
With the Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights.
Yeah. Well, I'm encouraged by the way the elections went last Tuesday. Given that most of this, it's been bipartisan support for this measure, sadly, but most of it has been at the behest and at the initiative of some of the more conservative members, some of whom aren't with us anymore. And when the Republican Party was in the majority in the Senate, of course, they were able to control the agenda and committee hearings and all of that. So they were able to move this forward and get it to come to the floor as it did last summer. I'm hopeful that Democrats will have a different take on this and see things differently. both in terms sort of broadly and a high-minded view, is that they will recognize the importance of their work differently, to the point where they will not be content with fiddling around with trying to amend the Constitution about the flag, and be willing to take more thoughtful and assertive and helpful stances and deliberations on things like war and peace and the economy and educational benefits and benefits for veterans. And so I'm hopeful that it won't come up again during the 110th Congress, but I'm not entertaining any fantasy that that's going to come true. As far as the public support, for the first time since the First Amendment Center has been surveying the general public about their attitudes on this measure, the last survey in 2005, I believe summer of 2005, their finding was, again for the first time, that the majority of people opposed amending the Constitution to protect the flag. And I'm very encouraged by that, because of what I said earlier about the pragmatic utilitarian orientation of most elected officials about their reading of their constituents and what their constituents want. At a macro level, we can say at this point that per this First Amendment Center survey, most people do not want to amend the Constitution to protect the flag. So those two things, the way the election went Tuesday, the recent survey results, and perhaps the third thing, what might still be my kind of residual Vietnam, early or pre-Vietnam era of naivete and hopefulness, leads me to conclude that maybe this won't come up again, at least anytime soon. But we'll be ready if it does.
Yeah, since my government seems not to to respect political boundaries, how about mistreatment of the flag in Iraq or mistreatment of the flag in Sweden, for that matter? How would we handle that?
Well, who knows? Maybe we would decide to go to war over something like that. I don't know.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, well, you know, some sure would say we've gone for lesser causes than that.
Indeed.
So what the hell?
Yes.
but you know, I think why, I'll do a little Veterans for Peace commercial because it's something I believe in passionately. Why we bear the duty, that is, we veterans bear the duty to share our experiences and to witness from our experiences and to call attention to things that we think are incorrect or unjust or ill-advised is inescapable. We must do that. We have standing about these issues of war and peace. We have standing about these issues about freedom and denial of freedom. We have issues about what we think will help and strengthen our democracy versus things that will weaken and tear down our democracy. And we have got to speak out. We're not of the same mind. And clearly, there are many of us, thousands of us, progressives and thoughtful people who cower and cringe when we hear the veteran's position represented by groups such as the American Legion, the VFW,
yeah,
and those other groups that seem to be complicit with the war machine and in bed with militarism. And it's as if they've forgotten, if they ever knew, that people die in wars. Our
right.
group,
Preach
our
it,
Veterans
brother.
For Peace group, spent Saturday, Veterans Day, at a place here in Evansville called the Four Freedoms Monument, where we, for the fourth consecutive year, read the names of all U.S. casualties from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow.
Beginning at 11 o'clock. It took us about an hour, two and a quarter hours to do that. We did that because it's important for us, for the community, to hear those names. Those are individual human beings.
Yes.
Clearly, we don't have access to, but we recognize that there are countless tens of thousands of Iraqis who were killed, tens of thousands of Afghanistan citizens that were killed. War kills people, and at the end of the day, it really doesn't settle anything. And
that's right.
Veterans are duty-bound, I think, to convey that message if that's what they believe, and to not allow other people to speak for us, to define our views for us, and to define our desires for us. And Veterans for Peace does that.
And the effect that it has on future families, you
Absolutely.
Know, about on families and children who have suffered through some of the most horrible experiences that a man can devise. And how do they grow up then? How do they view
right.
the world? It's,
yep.
You know, we're creating so many, many terrorists, if you will,
mm-hmm.
by just by our actions.
Yeah, I agree. And it's senseless.
It is
can't
indeed.
Be justified. And we all have an obligation to, if we believe such, we have an obligation to do what we can to make it stop.
Yeah.
Just as I think Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights has an obligation to continue to protect the Constitution.
I'd like to see a constitutional amendment that would require us to respect the sovereignty of other nations.
Yeah, that would be cool. Well, and I've heard some suggestions made that, you know, if we have a Department of Defense, which initially started out as a Department of War,
yes.
shouldn't we also have a Department of Peace? That would be a nice
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich is proposing that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Gary, we okay. really appreciate you've been very articulate and clear, and boy, we appreciate the way you've laid out some of our feelings and things so clearly on this issue. About all I can say is thank you so much for being one of our brothers and continue your good work.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your efforts.
Thank you both very much for having me on your show, and I hope it was helpful to you and your listeners. I look forward to seeing you guys at the VFP convention in St. Louis, which isn't very far from us here.
No, you guys are pretty close.
Coming up in August.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Goodbye, guys. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
That's just really powerful. You see how important it is to have veterans' voice on KBOO Portland? See how I slipped that little thing right
I
in
see
there?
You
yeah,
slipped,
that,
slipping
yeah,
that in there.
Slipped
John.
That little station ID thing right in.
Yeah.
There,
you're very clever.
That's
that
right.
Way.
We got those three, we got three of them in now, so pretty much every 15 minutes. Gary May is the chairman of the Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights. And if you want more information, it's a very interesting, website, to go to. It's just veteransdefending.org. We'll put you right on that website, and I think it will be interesting. And of course, Veterans for Peace, we at Northwest Veterans for Peace here agree. He brought up some good points, didn't he, Bill?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. We seem to be caught up in this country over quibbling over things like flag desecration and things that really have no real significance in everyday life for most of us. And, you know, we're caught up in the pursuing of these kinds of efforts. And I'd like to see us be more, give more discussion to things like, what is my government doing and how is my government paying for it? And, is there a fair distribution of the wealth, of this great nation? And, who benefits by our activities such as going on in Iran and Iraq right now? You know, that old saw about, follow the dollar is really significant or becomes more significant as we learn more and more about the depredation of these Blackwater and contractors and people who profit magnificently or generously from the war.
Well said, Bill. We're looking at the clock, and we want to cover a couple of things that Bill and I talked about a little bit ahead of time. And I'm going to read something that I don't – there's a couple of parts in it that I may not totally agree with, but it was written by a chaplain in the U.S. Marine Corps, Father Dennis Edward O'Brien. And – it gives a little picture. It just says, what is a veteran? We've just had Veterans Day and,
yes.
And all the things that went with that, and so we're going to come back to that a little bit. But Father O'Brien wrote this, and there are some good points in it. What is a veteran? Some veterans bear visible signs of their service. A missing limb, a jagged scar, a certain look in the eye. Others may carry the evidence inside them. A pin holding a bone together, a piece of shrapnel in the leg, or perhaps another sort of inner steel. The soul's ally forged in the refinery of adversity. Except in parades, however, the men and women who have kept America safe wear no badge or emblem. You can't tell a vet just by looking. What is a vet? He is a cop on the beat who spent 6 months in Saudi Arabia sweating 2 gallons a day making sure the armored personnel carriers didn't run out of fuel. He's the barroom loudmouth, dumber than 5 wooden planks, whose overgrown frat boy behavior is outweighed by 100 times in the cosmic scale by 4 hours of exhausted bravery near the 38th parallel. She, or he, is the nurse who fought against the futility and went to sleep, sobbing every night for 2 solid hours in Da Nang. He is the POW who went away one person and came back another, or didn't come back at all. He is the Quantico drill instructor who has never seen combat, but has saved countless lives by turning slouchy, no-account rednecks and gang members into Marines and teaching them to watch each other's back. He is the parade-riding legionnaire who pins on his ribbons and medals with a prosthetic hand. He is the career quartermaster who watches the ribbons and medals passing by. He is the three anonymous heroes in the Tomb of the Unknowns, whose presence at Arlington National Cemetery must forever preserve the memory of all the anonymous heroes whose valor dies unrecognized with them on the battlefield or in the ocean's sunless deep. He is the old guy bagging groceries at the supermarket, palsied now and aggravatingly slow, who helped liberate a Nazi death camp and who wishes all day long that his wife were still alive to hold him when the nightmares come. He is an ordinary and yet extraordinary human being, a person who offered some of his life's most vital years in the service of his country and who sacrificed his ambitions so others would not have to sacrifice theirs. He is a soldier and a savior and a sword against the darkness, and he is nothing more than the finest, greatest testimony on behalf of the finest, greatest nation ever known. He is a beggar on the street corner, holding up a piece of cardboard and scribbling, "Help a vet. Hungry." So remember, each time you see someone who has served our country, just lean over and say thank you. That's all most people need, and in most cases, it will mean more than any medals they could ever have been awarded or were awarded. 2 little words that mean a lot. Thank you. Francis Dennis Edward O'Brien, Chaplain, USMC. Yes. And there's some good elements to that, Bill, that I read, because we had a very, very fine example today of what a veteran is with Gary May, that was our guest on the program, tucked there in the university back in Indiana, but doing good work and upholding a real kind of patriotism. And I get tired of some of this phony patriotism. You know, the car dealer putting up American flags to make you think he's patriotic so he can cheat you out of money and get you in a car upside down. I want to let you talk a little bit, Bill. I want to tell just one quick story. I flew down to Southern California. I was telling Bill earlier, and my heart just ached on the plane down to the funeral. Young fella in the row next to me there was, he'd been a National Guard, and he was on his way to Fort Campbell. He had gone from the National Guard to the RA, the regular Army, for this reason. Married and had a kid. the National Guard didn't have benefits to sustain them, and they were having trouble making ends meet, and they needed medical things, and so he was going in the regular Army. And I want to say this carefully, but in talking with him, you could tell that he certainly was not the valedictorian of the class, and was probably lacking in some intellectual areas and schooling, not real bright. And I just ached at what the Army is going to do in using him up. And I thought of, I wonder what kind of promises they made him in thinking they were going to take care of him. And that's the type of thing that I think Congress ought to be addressing rather than this phony stuff about what you do with a piece of cloth.
Yeah, that brings to my mind the No Child Left Behind, whose intention it was to provide military recruiters with lists of names of prospective recruits, and how awful that is as far as I'm concerned, the fact that you have to opt out rather than opt in to a program like that. And some of the elements of the comments that you wrote about what is his name, Brady,
right,
that wrote about veterans aptly describe George W. Bush and Dick Richard Cheney and
Rumsfeld.
Yeah, we have a bunch of those people. We have Richard Pearl and the whole bunch of those war hawks that are willing to send your children for a futile effort that we're pursuing in Iraq, which has no end. And if we win the war, how are we going to know we've won the war? What government have we defeated? What people have we beaten down and made to respond to our commands?
What is it we won?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a guy in the Vietnam time, almost forgot his name. Boy, that's a pleasure. McNamara, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't think I could ever forget that name, and I didn't think there would probably ever be anybody that I disrespected more than him. But then along came Rumsfeld,
Well, you don't want to leave old Henry out.
No, we sure don't.
We've been blessed with some progressive and thoughtful leaders in this country. Those leaders that are concerned about the welfare of the commonweal. And I get so sick and tired of having my government speak down to me and tell me that I don't understand the situation, that it's too complex for me to understand it. Only those of us in high office are blessed with the knowledge to make decisions that will benefit who? It's just nothing short of disgusting to me.
Absolutely. But they got to keep those campaign funds fat.
Indeed.
Did I really say that? Bill, we talked just a little bit earlier, and we're starting to close in. We got a great announcement. You stay tuned because we got a great announcement we're going to close with when we get to it. But let's take maybe a minute, 2 minutes. We talk about veterans a lot. But that's an individual. And the majority of these have families. And share some of your thoughts about, because I know we're on the same wavelength there.
Yeah, I'd like to see an open discussion regarding the welfare of the families whose breadwinners have been sent over to this place in the Middle East called Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, whoever the enemy du jour happens to be. and then have television ads asking us to provide the needs for these families. You know, it's such an insult to me.
That's right.
That those poor people have to go with their hat in their hand trying to keep body and soul together while the government uses up their most precious asset, which is the loved ones that are being tormented and abused by the military.
Thank you for listening to Veterans Voice on KBO Portland. We are veterans. We're veterans for peace. And I'm for recognizing and honoring veterans, but not in the way of just waving a flag around that doesn't do any good for them. We need to stay and keep, and all of you I know have supported very well real veterans issues and causes. And so I thank you for that and want you to continue to do that. Let me just tell you, we have great news. The documentary, Left to Die, Causeway Concentration Camp, New Orleans, USA, 205, by Portland filmmaker Elizabeth Attlee, will be held over one more day at the Baghdad Theater. And that's 3702 Southeast Hawthorne. The documentary will feature several people who were held in prison camp-like conditions at the freeway intersection in the New Orleans after the Hurricane Katrina. Now, that will play at 6 p.m. on Thursday, November the 16th. So we got an extra day in there, and I think that's great news. And thank you again for listening to Veterans Voice. We're looking forward to seeing you again next month.
Elizabeth always does a good job.
For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.
And you are listening to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up, we're going to hear an interview with Omayele Sowore, one of Nicaragua's most prominent activists. He's been imprisoned 8 times and tortured for promoting democracy. He'll speak about the human impact of corporate oil interest in Nigeria, I'm sorry. And also in the same interview is Jordan Rodig. And I'm not sure what Jordan does, so you're going to have to stay tuned, and Eve is going to tell you all about that. But before I go to Eve, at 10:30, Martha Odom will be interviewing local activists from Lewis and Clark College who have recently formed a chapter of Students for Democratic Society. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, a debate on the issues of out of Iraq or more troops with George McGovern, Dennis Kucinich, and the American Enterprise Institute's Joshua Muravchik. And a look at the new battle brewing in Congress over how the U.S. government monitors the money it spends on the reconstruction of Iraq. And at noon on Alternative Radio, the speaker is activist and author Antonia Yuhas, speaking on oil-garchy. So now, we're going to go to Eve.
Good morning. My name is Eve Sokolai, and I'm here today to bring you an interview with a human rights activist from Nigeria. Human rights groups estimate that in the last 10 years, military factions acting on behalf of multinational oil companies have killed more than 2,000 people in the Niger Delta. According to Human Rights Watch, multinational oil companies are complicit in abuses committed by the Nigerian military and the police. Omoyele Sowore of Nigeria has been imprisoned 8 times and tortured for promoting democracy in Nigeria. He will speak tomorrow here in Portland about the impact of corporate oil and interests in Nigeria. We have him on the phone today, and we also have another guest to help speak with him. But a little background, before we go on, I'll let you know that Mr. Sowore has spent the last 15 years working to promote human rights and democracy in Nigeria and to stop the militarization and violence that multinational oil companies have brought to his country. He is currently in the U.S. receiving treatment for the effects of torture. Sowore is speaking across the United States as part of an international delegation from communities severely impacted by oil overconsumption and global warming. The delegation, whose members are from the Arctic, Micronesia, Iraq, Nigeria, and the U.S. Gulf Coast, are going out to communities throughout the United States to educate audiences and talk about how the oil industry and global warming are affecting their communities. And I have today with me Mr. Omoyele Sowore speaking with us, and I'm not sure where you are in the country. Are you here in Portland now?
Actually, I'm in Olympia, in Washington State.
Well, welcome to the program. I'm so glad you could take the time to speak with us today. I also have on the line Jordan Rodig, who is the alum club coordinator for Peak Oil and Environmental Justice Task Force from Portland Community College. So he is excited to speak with you as well, and I'm hoping that you can just start out by telling us your message. What will you be telling the students at Portland tomorrow?
Well, first I'd like to say that I'm glad to be on the program, and nice to meet you this way, Mr. Sowore.
Thank you.
Yes, so my message to what I will be... are you asking the message that I will be delivering to the students of Portland Community College, or the
yes.
message that I have been delivering, or the message of the Peak Oil Environmental Justice Task Force?
Well, I assume that you will be at Mr. Sowore's
session
tomorrow. What message will you be bringing the audiences to present tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow... Mr. Sowore is scheduled to speak at Portland Community College, Sylvania campus at 11. And I will probably be, I'm not exactly sure how much I will be speaking at the event, maybe none, but I can say that messages that I have been delivering to students in classrooms and in different methods throughout campus through faculty and whatnot, and with the help of many organizations around Portland, is that of working together to build sustainable communities of inclusiveness that can, weather and thrive after a transition away from oil, which is an inevitable transition that we are going to encounter once the main resource that we use to fuel our entire society and economy is no longer viable. And it's a massive issue with, people are looking at from various perspectives, political, economic, social, and it's something that I look at from the environmental justice perspective, or how is this intense transition and massive economic restructuring and social restructuring going to impact different groups of people and different types of people based on their class or race or any sort of status in the United States. And we ask questions like, who is going to be included in the discussion for solutions and who is going to be included in the restructuring process and who is going to benefit after you know, we restructure and transition away from oil? And more most pressingly, how soon are we going to address this issue, and in what ways can we address it right now to help remedy the effects that are already being felt by people, you know, on the lowest tiers of our class system, and you know, people who are already feeling the effects of rising prices of gas that have, you know, are affecting prices of food, of transportation, of heat, and you know, how can we work immediately to include the people who are going to be most affected by this issue?
Very good. If you could stay on the line with us, Jordan, I'm going to allow Mr. Sawari to speak with us and give us an overview of what his message is here. And if you have any questions for him later on in the program, we'll be glad to take them from you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sawari, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great
Thank
to
you
have
for
you. Thank you so
me.
Much. Yes, I can hear you well. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well now.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much for coming on to the program. We're very excited to have you here in Portland to speak to us face-to-face about the really dire issue of global warming and the effects of the oil industry on your country and other countries as well, right here in the United States, in fact. Can you tell us a little bit, give us an overview of your message here in the United States while you visit with us?
Well, this is a message that's sponsored by Global Exchange, and we have, I mean, a lot of speakers have been visiting different parts of the United States to talk about the effects of oil, and our specific message, mine in particular, is not to talk to U.S. citizens in a way that distances them from the problem, or in a way that makes them feel sympathetic towards the countries that are directly affected by pollution created by the oil companies, but in a way that makes them understand that all of us are in this together, that, you know, the devastation of the environment, the burning of the ozone layer created by reckless consumption of fossil fuel is also responsible for threatening, you know, the peace of the entire world. And this message has been brought home and closer with the Katrina in New Orleans and all other human rights abuses and the retrenchment of fundamental human rights that is happening and even being championed by this country, the United States of America, in places like Iraq and other parts of the world where oil or the desire to consume oil or take over oil resources has become the reason or justification for fighting wars that are completely unnecessary. It's all of this together that is the package in which I speak to young people, especially students, to challenge them to not only protect the rights of minorities everywhere, including in this country, because not only is oil a problem and the exploration of it a problem in Nigeria, it's also a problem in New Orleans ahead. So this is the message. It's just to make all these connections, a global connection of how these issues are connected and affects everybody, both the people who suffer from exploration and the final product consumers, in this case, citizens of the U.S. who consume about 25% of oil that comes out right out of Nigeria, Niger Delta area, that I always, I'm not afraid to say that contains blood of people who have been killed for the exploration on the shipping of this crude oil to get to you.
You've been working for the last 15 years to promote human rights and democracy in Nigeria, and it seems as though over and above democracy, democracy is not working for the people. Why do you think that is happening in Nigeria?
Well, the problem is that all of us just make this assumption that because elections take place, we have democracy. It is a lot more than that. Democracy involves people's ability, not only just the ability to go and vote on election day,
but also the right to or ability to continue to maintain and sustain themselves in such a way that they have a strong voice before, during, and after elections, you know. And of course, you now know that elections are just not adequate anymore, but, you know, counting of votes and properly documenting them and giving the, you know, the winner of such elections their position. These ingredients of, ingredients of, democracy has been denied Nigerians. And so what we have, as documented by human rights groups, pro-democracy groups, and even U.S. government officials who visited Nigeria in 2000 elections and 2003, is that what we have is a sham and a scam, and we cannot call that democracy, because what that process produced are a bunch of morons who are running the country on behalf of the oil companies and kleptomaniacs. So we call the Nigerian democracy kleptocracy, in aptly so.
What have you been doing in your work to bring awareness to the people of Nigeria and get them proactive in their government so that they can better watch their leaders and better bring them to call on their actions?
I didn't hear this last question. I was having a problem with reception. Can you repeat that?
Sure. I'm sorry. It was a long question. What have you specifically been doing in Nigeria to promote human rights and to activate the Nigerian people so that they can have their government account to them?
Well, we have been involved right from my student days in the university where I started and caught my teeth as an activist fighting against World Bank and IMF economic policies that promote some of these abuses that I'm talking about. Up until now, we have engaged in direct action against the government, which led to my going to detention and prison 8 different times. I was tortured, at some point injected with poison, which made me to come to the U.S. to seek treatment. And over and above that, we have continued to develop peaceful and nonviolent means of educating and creating awareness for the people in the Niger Delta. For example, you must have heard that there were times that women took over badges owned by Chevron, you know, naked. And in the Niger Delta, about 2,000 women who were local women just went there and took over the badges and to demand for their rights. So those are some of the, you know, the actions and reactions that have come out from some of this awareness that we're creating. Of course, I am a little bit now more remotely cut off from direct action in Nigeria because I'm not on the ground, and I'm somehow a persona non grata in Nigeria because of my activism. But from here, we have continued to shine light on what is going on in Nigeria. I run a website that reports corruption, for example, in Nigeria, and it's called SaharaReporter.com, and it is purely a non-profit individual effort to shine the light on this and mobilize Nigeria, you know, with information that is otherwise not available to the local media, to propel people to understand that corruption is still going on in Nigeria, and it happens right at the top. And the presidency in Nigeria actually is adjudged the most corrupt department in Nigerian hierarchy. So we do all of this, and we hope that people just take this information and run with it and take the necessary action that that they can use in bringing about the change that is very much desirable and in some cases belated in Nigeria.
Omoyele Sowore has spent the last 15 years working to promote human rights and democracy in Nigeria. You're tuned here to KBOO 90.7 FM, and he's speaking with us right now. He will be in Portland tomorrow to speak at the Smith Center Ballroom in Portland State University at 6 p.m. That's tomorrow, Thursday night, November 16th. And for more information, you can go to globalexchange.org. We also have on the line with us Jordan Rodig, who is the Peak Oil and Environmental Justice Task Force Student Club co-coordinator, a long but important title. Jordan, are you there with us? Do you have a question for Mr. Sowore?
I certainly have many. I would like, I would like to know, I don't exactly know how much of the United States you've experienced so far as you know, the effects of oil in our communities. But I'd like to know what your perspective is coming from Nigeria, where you are trying to institute democracy to work against the effects of oil corporations, and then being here in a society that, to some extent, operates on democracy, you know, where these oil corporations are largely based and have really created our society. What have you observed about the relationship, and what progress do you think is being made or should be made?
Well, I think that my greatest shock coming to the U.S. is to find out, because I came in 1999, and then the 2000 election was happening, and I found out that, you know, the faces that were somehow largely responsible for the oil corporate abuse in Nigeria had taken over power in the U.S. as well. So there was also an oil oligarchy that I saw here, and that was very, very worrisome to find out. And this is not making any political statement about the U.S., but I saw a lot of oil interest, and I think there was like some kind of oil corporate takeover of the government here, and that was worrisome. And I think that was responsible for the reduction of the U.S. capability to intervene as a moral voice in stopping these oil companies from doing what they do in Nigeria and Ecuador, in places like Burma, where there's also no democracy and there's a retrenchment of human rights and the abuse of a lot of rights. I think it has led the U.S. Shift its focus or look the other way while their corporations do all this terrible business with people who sometimes we refer to from the U.S. perspective as rogue nations and rogue individuals. And also, you know, the withdrawal, for example, from the Kyoto Protocol and some other unilateral actions taken by the U.S. Just definitely continue to encourage, you know, these petty dictators and kleptomaniacs and petty bourgeois African governments from, you know, listening to the U.S. They just weren't worried anymore because they knew that the U.S. Can no longer speak authoritatively on human rights and environmental rights because the U.S. had become immersed or engrossed in the business of violating human rights. For example, you know, the U.S. was involved in rendition and torture, and those things just robbed a lot of people the opportunity of the moral voice that the U.S. Would otherwise have wielded, you know, globally. So that was a major, major shock for me when I got into this country, and that hasn't changed really, and it's part of what I try to encourage people to speak out also here, because when you have that kind of situation, you know, dilemma globally, the citizens of such countries must rise up and speak out so that people can differentiate between their own interest and corporate interest.
Yeah, definitely. It's great of you to point out the way that oil affects U.S. foreign policy, and I think that, like you said, it causes the United States government to often look the other way, but I think that is, you know, the least that they do. If they don't look the other way, they're often engaged, you know, with the interests of oil to promote war, to fuel war, and violations of human rights in other countries.
Mr. Sawari, what is the number one thing that you suggest, the first thing that a citizen can do to take action against big oil and its insidious effect on our governments throughout the world?
Well, I often encourage people to use their economic power. It doesn't require a lot from the standpoint of U.S. citizens to use their economic power to stop big oil, because we can cut back on our consumption of big oil or fossil fuel. I often see people who are out of patriotism, quote unquote, drive big cars, you know, on our highways, cars that they don't need. There are people who have never climbed mountains before who are running around with Ford F-150s. And that is emboldening companies like Ford, you know, to just produce all this behemoth of vehicles that we don't need. So the major issue is the consumption disease, you know, that is ravaging this country, that people just consume everything and anything, and in most cases things that are not necessarily to be consumed. When I speak, sometimes people just ignorantly ask me, oh, you know, if we stop buying oil in Nigeria, don't you think Nigerians will starve to death? Don't you think people in Ecuador will starve to death? And I said, no, because the truth is that you've been buying oil since 1956 from Nigeria. You've been doing all kinds of resource business in Africa since whenever. And yet, African babies are still up for sale to people like Madonna, you know, in Malawi, because of the poverty. So there's, you know, you find out that, you know, in the face of this so-called economic consumption and help that goes to Africa, Africans are actually poorer. So I think we have to just straight up cut back on the consumption of oil, because that not only will protect our own environment back home, it would also protect your own environment, you know, protect the skies and the atmosphere, you know, and everybody will be safe, and the globe will warm less, and we will not be threatened by sea rise and the thawing of, you know, glaciers up north and down south of the globe or the pole. So these things are very important, that we make people know that this is not an issue of sympathy with the Nigerian people. It's a consumption problem. And the U.S. have no excuse whatsoever, as one of the most advanced countries in the world technologically and scientifically, not to be able to produce vehicles that don't consume things that destroys our world. And those vehicles, if they are produced, alternatives that are there in large numbers that have been discouraged by lobbyists in this country, can also be shipped to these other countries to also discourage them from destroying their own environment. So the bottom line is that number one thing is for people to cut back on their consumption, but as a short measure, we need people in this country to boycott some of these very vicious oil corporations, you know, and like Shell, Chevron, who have been indicted or who are even facing charges in civil courts. For example, Shell is facing, class action suits in New York over the killing of Kenneth Arruwa, which we regard as contract killing by Shell to the military in Nigeria in 1995. November 10th, a few days ago, was 11th anniversary of Kenneth Arruwa's killing. And so we expect that these actions will take place. You boycott the companies, you know, and let them know that you don't support what they do. And it will bring a lot of change, because we saw it happen with Coca-Cola in South Africa. And some of those actions cumulatively resulted to the collapse of appetite, you know. So we have to do something, you know, in the short term and in the long term, to bring about the collapse of the organized oil, you know, greed that is ravaging the world and destroying the environment, killing people, just to make huge oil companies declare quarterly profits. I mean, quarterly profits actually that are more than budgets of five African countries combined together.
So our number one action is to cut back on consumption of oil and to make a conscious effort to take action and talk to your leaders, take political action, to let them know what you're doing, why you're doing it, and why it's important not only to us here in the U.S. and to everyone in the world. And it affects not only economies and the health of people generally, but on the entire globe.
I can't hear you at this point. I think we're having connection problems.
Well, thank you for joining us, Mr. Sowari. We really appreciate your being on with us today, and we look forward to your talk at Portland State tomorrow. Mr. Sowari will be at the Smith Center Ballroom at 6 p.m. Thursday, November 16th. That's tomorrow night at Portland State University. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. And if you want more information about his tour, you can go to www.globalexchange.org for information about that. Thank you again for joining us, Mr. Sowari. And thank you, Jason.
Jordan, excuse me.
Thank you, Jordan Rodig from the Peak Oil and Environmental Justice Task Force Student Club at Portland Community College.
Thank you very much.
And if you want to leave quickly some contact information for your group, and then
Well, if you are a student at Portland Community College, we are very well advertised. We are a chartered student club. The acronym is POET. And we
we have a presence at Sylvania campus right now, but we are increasing our network between the campuses, and we currently have a pretty decent network built with several other organizations that are focused on building community throughout Portland, such as Tryon Life Community Farm and the City Repair Project, just to name two of them, and also the Peak Oil Task Force, Portland Peak Oil Task Force. It's mostly for students at the community college, because that's the community that we choose to spread our message around to the Portland metro area.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Jason. Jordan. Pardon me. Jordan. Okay. You're tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and we're going to go out here and stay tuned.
The beat goes on. Drums keep pounding the rhythm to the rhythm. La-di-da-di-di. La-di-da-di-da. Charles thing was once the rage on. History has turned a page up. The mini skirts, the current thing on. TV bopping our newborn king up. And the beat goes on. Grocery stores, a supermart. Little girls still break their hearts. Men just keep on marching after war.
Stay tuned now. Martha Odom will be interviewing local activists from Lewis and Clark College who recently formed a chapter of Students for a Democratic Society. And at 11, Democracy Now! Today there will be a debate on the issue of out of Iraq or more troops. And at noon, Alternative Radio, the speaker is activist and author Antonia Yuhas, who is speaking on oilgarchy. So, here's Martha.
Good morning, Cascadia. This is Martha Odom for KBOO News and Public Affairs. With us in the studio today are Adam Sanchez and Mary Sackley, Lewis and Clark College students. Welcome, Adam. Welcome, Mary.
Good morning.
They are members of Students for Democratic Society, an organization that was amazingly active during the 60s, early 70s, has been lying quiet for the longest time and was recently resurrected at the start of this year. Adam, do you want to tell a little bit about the history of the old SDS?
Okay, I can give a little bit about what I know. As far as I see it, from the books I've read, SDS was really an inspiration to a movement and an inspiration to a generation by really taking a radical stance and trying to change the fabric of society. They were at the forefront of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and they led some of the largest student protests, including the infamous 68 protests at the Democratic National Convention. And I think in general the history of SDS is something that a lot of activists, and especially student activists today, look at something as being very inspirational. And I definitely look back to it and see many positive aspects, and I think that's why you see this not only many positive aspects, but also very many connections with what was going on then and what's going on now. And I think that's why you're seeing this resurgence of SDS right now.
It's amazing to read the Port Huron statement, Tom Hayden's manuscript from 1960, I think, and to discover that it is so applicable today, it takes very little editing before we could issue the Port Huron statement all over again.
Definitely. Tom Hayden is, I mean, always has been writing since the Port Huron statement incredible pieces, and his pieces definitely have much resonance from the 60s on.
The old SDS did a lot of teach-ins against the war. Is the new SDS working or considering any of that sort of thing?
Definitely. I think we're at Lewis and Clark, we're hoping to plan a teach-in pretty soon. Not only against the war, I know there's a lot of interest in, at least for me and a couple other people at Lewis and Clark, to do a teach-in just on student struggle in general. In 2006, there was a lot of really interesting things going on in the last couple of years, not only nationally but internationally. I think a lot of people still don't know about the kind of police brutality that's been going on against students in the last couple of years that you saw at UC Santa Cruz with Tent University. You saw again in Olympia with the port blockade, and I think that sort of stuff really needs to be shown to students, and people need to start reacting to it.
SDS1 was also very involved in discussing, debating campus issues. Mary, do you have any sense that the resurrected SDS are involved in issues right on campus other than repression?
I know that definitely our branch of SDS at Lewis and Clark is very interested in those issues, especially since it's such a new movement. An important way to get interest in that is to work on issues that are directly affecting people's lives on the campus, especially since that's where we live our lives every day. It's very much our own little world in a way. I think that campus issues are a really important issue for SDS to work on, both because they're important issues to our life and because being on a campus is a kind of a unique opportunity to have a lot of control over a little slice of the world that maybe isn't so spread out of a problem as over the rest of the world.
I'm pretty familiar with campus issues, food, housing, ID cards at Portland State, and I noticed that Lewis and Clark and Reed both have SDS chapters. Portland State doesn't. Are they going to come online pretty soon?
We don't know about that. I guess hopefully so, but there are some activist organizations there, and maybe after our conference this weekend, they'll decide to change their name.
Yeah, Portland State has a group called Students for Unity, and we've been definitely talking with them and conversing with them. I don't know if our real goal is to, you know, like get them to change their name to SDS, but we definitely want to work with groups at all campuses a lot more.
Well, you can tell them that lots of us wear multiple hats. We just keep a whole wardrobe in our back pocket. 4 months or so before the convention in 68 in Chicago, SDS called a student strike and more than a million students walked out, which is probably a great lead-in into the convention. There's some discussion of general strike ongoing. Hard thing to organize. Any thoughts on that?
I think that student strike is definitely a really, really effective means of protest that has been used. Striking in general is obviously one of the most common forms of protest, or certainly one of the most historically, it's been really effective. But I think at this point, it's still the new beginnings of an organization, but certainly that seems like a great goal to lead towards would be a million students in SDS all working together.
In the course of the summer, I saw student walkouts in high schools in many places for immigrant rights, and it's the most impressive grassroots organizing I've seen in a long time.
Definitely.
Definitely, yeah. Students are really starting to get active. I think you're seeing a definite increase in the last few years in student activity.
Why do you think that is? I come from SDS one generation. In the 80s, there was a fair amount of student activism. In the 90s, it just totally went away. And there is definitely a resurrection in the past year.
Well, I don't know if my analysis will suffice as the analysis for the organization, but personally, I think a lot of it has to do with the way the Democratic Party is conducting itself. And I think the Democratic Party, instead of trying to make a clear break with the Republican Party, and being staunchly anti-war, being, pro-gay rights, a whole slew of pro-immigrant rights, whole slew of things, I think they're taking a much more moderate stance. And I think that's causing a lot more radical students to really become disillusioned with the Democratic Party and realize that we need more than just voting. We need to get active. We need to organize.
The new SDS was reborn in January of this year. Want to tell a little bit about how that happened, this resurgence of student activism, and interesting that SDS should be the phoenix rising from the ashes.
Well, basically, as I understand it, a high school student from Connecticut, Pat Corte, called up a few older SDS members, including Al Haber, and basically pitched them this idea of reforming SDS. And together with a couple other students and interested older SDS members, they started contacting branches around the country that were still around, that maybe had a website here and there. And so they started creating this network of branches that were still around from around the country. And then they signed Thomas Good onto the project, who created a website for the new SDS. And when that happened, chapters just started forming everywhere. Since then, I think there's been over 200 chapters formed. And in terms of numbers of chapters, right now we are as big as SDS was in 1966, which is pretty promising since we've done that, pretty promising because since we've done that all in less than a year. And I think that's really exciting to look for. And the other really interesting thing is there's a lot more high school chapters this time around, which is, you know, going to be interesting in terms of new kind of civil rights movement for these people who are under 18 and still don't have voting rights but are really educated and really active.
Mm-hmm. The numbers are reassuring, but it's also amazing that we have gone from the iPod and what jeans you wear and Britney Spears mentality into radicalization in almost no time at all. It is a groundswell that's exciting.
Definitely.
The old SDS, and Mary, maybe you'll address this, definitely had gender issues, and that may well have contributed to its decline or hibernation or whatever. Has the new SDS, there was also a general being inclusive issues. Is the new SDS addressing these, and have we definitely come away from that?
The new SDS is definitely very, very aware of the history of the marginalization of many minority groups, and so specifically the gender diversity and the racial diversity. And I think it's important to note that already, certainly within our branch of SDS, it's pretty much 50-50 males and females. And overall, I haven't seen a lot of other SDSers across the nation yet, but it seems like it's definitely a far more gender inclusive movement. I think it's both because of the successes of the feminist movement, and also because it just, in general, college populations now, it's much more 50-50 male and female. So that opportunity is far more prevalent than it was before. We're very conscious of that history, and it's definitely something that we don't want to repeat. In terms of what we're doing about it, we're trying to definitely focus on issues, not necessarily focus, but make sure that we encompass issues that are relevant to those groups, and then also at general meetings that we have, such as at the National Convention and at the Northwest Regional Convention coming up this weekend, having discussion groups and safe spaces for those groups to make sure that everyone feels like it's safe for them to be included.
Thank you. The old SDS definitely had a socialist perspective, and maybe there's just baggage that comes with that word. Is it political spectrum inclusive also?
That's definitely the vision that is set out for it. We don't want to alienate anyone. I think that at the polarized climate that we're at right now, it, both within the radical movement and on the left, and in terms of the whole political spectrum, it's really important to not push yourselves away from people, and instead try and get as much involvement as possible, and try and find some compromise instead of saying, well, your ideology is different than mine, so we can't get along at all. There's a lot of room for compromise, and I think that the new SDS is very ready to work for that.
And within our local branch, there are people who identify as anarchists, there are people who identify as socialists, there are people who identify as Democrats, as liberals, so it's definitely, especially in the Northwest, a very diverse group of political leanings.
Might be time to come up with some new words, because all the old ones do carry baggage. Just set up flags. The resurrection hasn't been without problems, especially Pace University in New York are having struggles with being recognized.
Definitely. There's actually quite a few numbers of SDS branches that are having trouble just being recognized by their colleges. Luckily, since in the Northwest we are mostly based in liberal arts colleges at this point, we haven't had much of a problem with being recognized, and a number of our chapters in the Northwest have actually been getting a decent amount of funding from the schools for the organization. But that's definitely a national problem that you see, not only with Pace, but a lot of the chapters in the South, are dealing with that issue. And it's something that, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do a lot of work with here, because it's not really an issue in the Northwest as far as it's come at this point. But it's definitely something that we want to fight for, and we want to make sure that SDS branches around the country are being recognized.
So locally in the Northwest, you or SDS groups participated in Olympia at the Stryker convoy blockade?
SDS Olympia did. Actually, at that point, when that happened, Olympia was the only SDS branch in the Northwest.
And they'd only been around for a week at that point.
Yeah.
And that's right. I'd read that. They organized a week, 5 days or something like that before the blockade. It turned very effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, the vast majority of the branches in the in the Northwest have formed in the last 3 months, including the two branches in Portland and one in Bellingham that actually just got started about 3 weeks ago.
This is, as I said in the Congress, fast-tracking from, from January 2006, National Convention, August of 2006, and on this weekend, the Northwest SDS Conference here, the regional conference. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
The conference is coming up starting this Friday and then also Saturday and Sunday. We're going to open Friday. It's being hosted both by LCSDS and Reed. It's going to start Friday at Reed, and then the bulk of the activities will be during the day Saturday and Sunday at LC. There's branches coming from all over the Northwest, from Olympia, from Bellingham, from Tacoma, a few scattered people from Seattle and probably other parts of Oregon.
There's one person even coming up from Oakland.
That's right. There's someone flying in from Oakland to come to the conference. We have several activist groups from the Portland area are going to be present, tabling there. And then what's really exciting about the conference are the workshops that we have planned that are being facilitated by people from all different areas, from all of the Northwest, from different branches, from Portland SDS, from activist groups. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the specific conferences?
Yeah, there's, as Mary said, there's tons of groups that are going to be doing workshops. There's PCASC is organizing a workshop. The Rainforest Action Network's organizing a workshop. A couple other activist groups, as well as a whole bunch by SDSers. I think the real difference between this and the national convention, and something that I think is really interesting about it, is that the vast majority of the workshops are organized by students and younger students, and so it'll be a really, really interesting mix.
Is it possible for people just to show up?
Oh, definitely.
Great. So you begin Friday night at Reed College. What time?
Registration is at 6 p.m. at Reed Psychology Building, and then the plenary will start at 7 p.m. and go until about 9. Saturday morning, registration is starting in the Miller Building at Lewis and Clark at 9 a.m., and we're going to go till 6 p.m. with a lunch break, a working lunch, free food. And then Sunday, we're going to start at 10 a.m. with a plenary session and then go until 4:45 p.m.
Yeah, speaking of free food, I should probably take this time to really thank Portland Food Not Bombs and the Red and Black Cafe because they're both donating food to the conference, and that was absolutely wonderful of
places.
Them.
Food Not Bombs is wonderful across the country. I'll give them a plug too. the night before the Troops Home Fast in D.C. on the road in front of the White House, our Last Supper was catered by Food Not Bombs. In New Orleans, Food Not Bombs was part of People's Just Survival post-Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And the Las Vegas Food Not Bombs had a person arrested in violation of their city ordinance prohibiting feeding the homeless. And I just read that the judge said, get out of my courtroom with that. So apparently going up against the system works sometimes. Tell me the content of some of these workshops and also contact if people are interested in specific workshops or directions or any of that kind of stuff. I think you have a housing, maybe even a ride board, so
yeah.
If those things are still available.
There's a website that people can get all the information at, which is newsds.org/nwregional. For Northwest Regional, and all the information's up there, the schedule of the workshops up there, and if you're coming from out of town, you need housing, you can request housing on that website. As far as the content of the workshops goes, it's incredibly diverse. We're having workshops on sweat-free organizing. We're having workshops at looking at the lessons we can learn from the Black Panthers. We're having workshops on environmental movements.
Military Commissions Act.
Military Commissions Act, yeah. There's actually a lot of workshops, and I'm having trouble remembering them all. We're having a lot of discussions also just about various issues.
Would you say the website again, and on your way out, leave it at the front desk so if people don't, the lead just broke in your pencil, that you can call into the station and get the information?
Definitely. It's newsds.org/NWregional.
Okay. Okay, we have a little bit of time left. Let's talk a little bit about your personal reasons for being involved in SDS, what you are hoping it will do, what brought you to this, and where are we going to go from here, maybe the challenges we're going to all face in the coming years.
Okay, well, I guess I'll start. One of the I just transferred to Lewis and Clark, so this is my first semester here. And the way I got involved in it was honestly just walking around campus, and I saw a flyer that I'm sure Adam put up that said SDS is meeting in the co-op, and I thought, wow, there really are radical people on this campus, because I'd kind of come here searching for, moving from the Midwest, searching for a more vibrant, radical climate than my small Midwestern town, and hadn't really found it yet. So I was really excited to see that SDS had been revived. I'd heard some rumors of it, but I wasn't really sure what was going on. So, I was very excited to hear that, a movement with such a historically significant name had been revamped. I think that can be really powerful. And my favorite part about being in SDS is that we have the opportunity to be a very multi-issue movement. I think that a lot of radical work that's being done in Portland and all over the world is very, very issue-centric, and really people seem to be pretty separated from each other, and it can be hard to find a group to work with especially if you're new to an area, or if you're just trying to get, if you're just one of those people who's frustrated and just want to do something to make change, it can be hard to find a group of people to ally with. It can be a very intimidating and sometimes even an alienating thing to just, if you're even gutsy enough to just show up to someone's meeting, it can be very hard to get involved. So I'm glad that SDS has been revisited, because I think that we have the opportunity to be a very inviting movement to people.
Thanks. And Adam?
I got involved with the new SDS pretty early on, probably about 2 weeks after they made the call for new members and set up the website. I think probably my main reasons for getting involved were simply knowing the history of the old SDS. I come from a very historically minded family. Both my parents are historians. Leftist historians, and I'm a history major. I couldn't escape it. And so I think it was really interesting to me to see this organization which so much history attached to it reforming. And so in terms of the problems and expectations that we face or have in the future, that's a pretty big topic. I could go on for a while about that. But I'd see there's a lot of problems we face. There's the general apathy, of the youth population that, I mean, is definitely waning, but is still there. And I think almost all SDS branches are, fighting with that too. I think another more complicated, problem, especially within Portland, is how to deal with places like Portland and like Lewis and Clark College that are in rhetoric, very liberal sounding, but still very hierarchical in nature. And the structure, for instance, of Lewis and Clark College is still, you know, still has a board of director, still has a president, is very, traditionally academically, hierarchically structured. And so, it's very hard when groups, organizations or cities or whatever have this kind of liberal-minded rhetoric to, kind of infuse more radical views, in it. And I think that, at least in Portland, is, one of the biggest problems we're struggling with at this point. In terms of expectations, I think, also talking about more locally, I think SDS is hopefully going to flourish in Portland. I think the reason for that is because it's not like these other more traditional radical organizations where, you know, you're selling papers twice a day or twice a week, you know, and it's very rigid in what you have to do. It leaves a lot of room for developing an activist culture. And I think that's culture is something that Portlanders really pride themselves off of. And so I'm really excited about the way SDS can involve itself in subversive art and kind of radically changing the culture in which we live in.
We have, oh, a little more than a minute left. I would like to contribute that I hope you will not forget to have fun. Because the best activism of all my life has involved creativity and fun. So here's your chance. Another minute to give a little publicity to your conference and talk it up, kids.
Okay, well, the conference, once again, is this weekend at Lewis and Clark and at Reed College. Mostly the bulk of the workshops will be Lewis and Clark on Saturday and Sunday. Once again, that website is newsds.org/NW Regional. NW stands for Northwest. We have workshops on everything from pirate radio to learning lessons from the Black Panthers to encompassing the transgendered movement.
Thank you so much. It sounds exciting. Adam Sanchez, Mary Sackley, Students for a Democratic Society at Lewis and Clark. Thanks again for joining us. And Adam, you'll leave the website at the front desk.
Definitely.
This
Thank
has
you
been
a lot.
Fun. I'll be looking forward to seeing you on the weekend.
Thank you.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up is Democracy Now! And after Democracy Now!, stay tuned at noon for Alternative Radio, where the speaker is activist and author Antonia Yuhas, who will be speaking on oligarchy. Until then, Democracy Now!